This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Fuck you, can't even sing.
Yeah, just sing something to get some pussy.
Ooh, baby, I like it raw. Yeah, baby, I like it raw. Ooh, baby, I like it raw. Yeah, baby, I like it raw. Shimmy y'all, shimmy yeah, shimmy yeah. Give me the mic so I can take it away. Off on the natural charge, bon voyage. Yeah, from the home of the Dodgers, Brooklyn squad. Who can't kill her, he's on the score. Rain on the college.
Place to be nation pop.
Even touch my skill. You got
the hard traveling fanboys are back. Baby. I am Greg Phillips. With me, as always, in our increasingly luxurious studios, our penthouse studios, rather, in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, is Nick Duke. Nick, how are you on this fine Canadian day?
I'm good. I'm just glad you decided to get off your lazy ass and host the show again, like you should be doing.
Well, quite frankly, sometimes even people with my incredible immune system do get sick on occasion.
Oh,
sometimes people,
oh,
even with
God
my emotional say fortitude, do
for
have
God
bad days
say
on occasion. So not all of us can be perfectly mediocre all the time like you, Nick. So,
well, you know, it's my job
to be great.
It's my job to be the Gary Danielson to your Vern Lundquist. Which is to say, not that I'm very good, but at least I'm better than you.
Curiouser and curious.
Which brings us to you know the sound. You know the sound of the Ho-Ho Loon ticker. And that sound, of course, is meant to inform you that, of course, Ho-Ho Loon is still alive in the WWE Cruiserweight Classic.
Cruiserweight Classic. Ho ho! Loon is going straight to the top, ladies and gentlemen. And yes, there's still room on the bandwagon.
In a couple of weeks, when he's leading the cruiserweight division on Raw to ratings the wrestling world has never seen, you'll be wishing you had bought a little stock in Ho Ho Loon Incorporated. But we'll
That's
be holding
right
it all. We'll be holding every single bit of it.
Absolutely. All that aside, the other big news in the world, in the sporting world, the recreation world, the entertainment world, other than Ho-Ho Loon's continued existence in the Cruiserweight Classic, is, of course, San Diego Comic-Con, which took place this past weekend in, well, San Diego, I suppose you would say.
And the Germans called it San Diego.
Which, of course,
in German,
right, means something.
Means Reginald Bell Johnson.
Right. You can separate it by 6 degrees or fewer from Reginald Bell Johnson, that's for sure. And in addition to that, this brought at the Comic-Con, there was a just deluge of comic book news and notes, big stories broken, rumors busted, rumors confirmed, everything you can imagine in the world of comic books, comic book film, comic book video games, comic books. Everything. Wrestling comic books.
Wait a minute.
Everything.
You mean to tell me that the San Diego Comic-Con actually has news about comic books that is broken there?
Well, not much, but some.
Hey, just the minimum amount. Just enough.
Yes. Comic-Con has would you – I don't know if you would say evolved or devolved from what it started as the centerpiece for fans to meet creators and get scoops and things like that, to now being basically a Hollywood production.
I blame Twilight.
Would you care to elaborate on that?
No.
Oh, well, fair enough. Speaking of Twilight, let's talk about comic books. So, as you know, folks, we have recurring features here on Hard Traveling Fanboys. Last week was the debut, or the debut, as they say in my neck of the woods.
As the ladies man Leon Phelps might say.
That's right. Don't put it in debit.
Depending on your preference.
The
And if you do put it in debit, make sure you do so at a medium pace.
Yes. And that was a very Jim Ross statement, by the way, Nick. You can put it in debit. Or you don't have to put it in debit. It's up to you, quite frankly. Do it at a medium pace, or hell, you can do it at a fast pace. Maybe even a slow pace. What the hell do I care? I don't know.
So long as you sauce it.
Sauce it. And speaking of saucing it, we're going to kick you off this week. We're not going to kick you off. We're going to kick it off this week. We could kick you off because it is our show, but we're not going to because we love you, the listeners.
And you're not actually here on the show, so we can't really kick you off.
Don't tell them that, Nick. They don't know. In any event, we're going to start off with the rundown, which has turned into our new weekly recurring feature in which we talk about things. So, there's a lot of news items, Nick, coming out of San Diego Comic-Con. A lot of news items.
Right, tons. I mean, it's always Comic-Con is both fun and challenging when you're not there, which I've never been there, so I don't know why I added that caveat to it. So it's both fun and challenging as a fan because it's fun because there's so much news happening, but it's challenging because there's so much news happening. It's hard to keep up. I mean, there were trailers that I just watched today, and this is 3 or 4 days after the event, you know, just a massive deluge of news, especially on Saturday when both Marvel Studios and Warner Brothers held their big movie panels, where we got looks, got lots of news about what the comic book big screen picture is going to look like over the next couple of years. So I guess that's as good a place as any to start. And let's start with what we actually got to see. And that being, Warner Brothers brought a pretty hefty amount of footage. Would you say?
Yes. A surprising amount of footage, in my opinion. I knew that we'd see one last Suicide Squad trailer, which we did.
Honestly, that was – I didn't dislike that trailer, but it was just kind of a thing that happened. I've seen enough from that movie at this point. I don't need to see any more. I don't want to see any more, honestly. I want to keep a little mystery for the movie. The trailer was very Harley-centric, but I already knew that I have a pretty good, inkling that I'm going to enjoy Harley in the movie. So that trailer was fine, but didn't really excite me in any way.
Right. No, and I have a confession. I actually lied to you before we went on the air, Nick. I did not watch the new Suicide Squad trailer because I did not want to, because I don't like having 400 different trailers for movies and seeing them all before I go to see the movie. So,
agreed.
I did not watch that. So anyway, I knew we would get that. I figured we would get a little bit of Wonder Woman footage. I didn't know that we'd get a full trailer, and I certainly didn't know that we would get significant footage from the set of Justice League. So I guess, do you want to start out with those two, Nick?
I mean, that's the place to start. And let's praise some things first. And to me, and this is just my opinion, and it's close because I think Marvel brought a very good trailer later on in the evening as well. But I thought, from my perspective, the Wonder Woman trailer was the trailer of Comic-Con, at least from a movie perspective. It was everything I wanted to see from a Wonder Woman trailer. The tone looks
everything you don't.
Exactly. The tone looked right. The action looked great. Gal Gadot's performance looked fantastic.
Yep.
Chris Pine bringing the humor and the snark, as he is wont to do, most notably in his Star Trek franchise. Just lots of great things about that trailer. Enjoyed almost everything about it, and just further cements Wonder Woman as my most anticipated DC movie of the next year. And yes, that includes Justice League.
Yes, I agree with all that, Nick. I thought Wonder Woman stole Comic-Con for DC and Warner Brothers. I thought Wonder Woman instantly shot to the top of my anticipated list.
Not there before?
It was there. It was very high. It was very high, but I think Suicide Squad was neck and neck with it. It surpassed Suicide Squad in terms of my hype now because – I still had some concerns about whether they'd get the tone right, whether they'd get, the characterizations right. You can't tell all that from a trailer, but as far as trailers go, that was damn good. That was everything that I could want from a Wonder Woman trailer. And like you said, it's looking good. Chris Pine looks like he's going to be a great Steve Trevor. They're letting him be himself, which is cool. Gal Gadot just looks phenomenal as Wonder Woman. And I'm intrigued. I think that the time period is going to be great. We haven't seen that out of any of the Warner Brothers movies as like a as a period piece. So it's gonna be cool to see in the backdrop of World War One, I believe.
Yes, World War One, not World War Two, which I like for a couple of reasons. One, World War Two has been done to death. I think you and I can both agree on that.
Absolutely.
And it helps it to avoid the Captain America comparisons, which will undoubtedly come as a result of it being a superhero origin piece, you know, period piece,
right.
I should say.
Right.
The other thing I like about it, which I didn't even put together in my head until a couple of days ago, the backdrop of World War One makes so much sense from a historical perspective because that's going on in history the same time as the women's suffrage movement. So you have this whole other historical backdrop. Not saying that's going to be a part of the plot, but it's there. If you go into the movie with that knowledge, it's kind of even a cooler – just a little thing that adds to it, in my opinion.
And it very well may be part of it, yeah.
Maybe part of it, and perhaps, you know, that Wonder Woman was an influence in that world into women getting the right to vote or something like that. So I think there's a ton to like in that trailer. Etta Candy, who is a character I've never cared about in the comics, really, and who only has one line in the trailer, nearly steals the trailer, I thought, with her little comic scene at the end.
Agreed.
With Chris Pine and Gal Gadot. So very much looking forward to the movie. I want to see more of the Amazons, honestly. That was the only thing from the trailer I wish we had seen more of was her fellow Amazons, because really only see Diana and Hippolyta with any real screen time. I mean, there are wide shots of some action and stuff, but I'm hoping that we get, you know, some good Amazonian interaction with Diana and her sisters and stuff, because I think that's a very important part of the mythos.
Certainly so. Now, the other big trailer, more of a teaser than an actual trailer, that was released by Warner Brothers.
Oh, man, it was 2.5 minutes long. Can you really call it a teaser?
Yeah, I mean, that's fair, but it was Justice League. We got actual footage from Justice League, which is shocking because they didn't start filming that long ago. Again, for them, mostly good. Looks like they're on the right track. They've got a different tone from Batman vs Superman. You've got certainly more humor thrown in. The cast seems more at ease with each other. It's a Batman who's more at ease with the world. And I thought that the charisma of Ben Affleck and Gal Gadot and the kind of unspoken charisma of Jason Momoa as Aquaman kind of carried that trailer for me. Would you agree?
I would agree. Everything that was related to those three characters was almost perfect in that trailer. It's the other things in the trailer that I have pause and concerns about, primarily the Flash.
Right.
And I don't mean to – I mean, it's a trailer. You can't really make snap – you can't really judge or performance or portrayal or even, you know, a subplot from a movie that doesn't come out for over a year based on a 2.5-minute snippet. But
right.
Based on what I saw alone – not overly impressed with their take on the Flash, and I will openly, freely admit part of that is due to my immense personal preference for the way Grant Gustin plays that character now. I'm all for different interpretations, but DC has allowed me to forge an emotional connection with one, and it feels I had the feeling going in it would feel this way, and it certainly does. It feels weird to me to see anybody else playing that character at this point. Hopefully by the time the movie rolls around, I won't feel that way. That's my hope, my sincere hope. I'm just being honest about how it feels right now.
I agree with all that. You know, I mentioned on Twitter that it's way too early to make a judgment positively or negatively on how he's going to do as the Flash. We simply don't know. It's the same, but to me, it brought back memories of the same situation with Jesse Eisenberg, where my first inclination of him was, that's not Lex. And it proved to be the case in the movie, for me anyway, that it wasn't Lex to me. And that's kind of my initial read on this is, at least in this footage, it was not Barry Allen. He played him almost – I used the word neurotically on Twitter, and that might have been the wrong usage, but – it did have some.
I think that's an apt description, personally.
Thank you. It was kind of Eisenbergian to me a little bit in terms of, you know, when he's like, "You're sitting in my second favorite chair. I need friends." You know, just like those are not. I just can't picture any version of Barry Allen that I've ever read or seen or heard delivering it like that. very
one of the things that you
very
and I
Peter Parker esque, I think, also more
right.
Peter Parker than Barry Allen.
Right, and what I was gonna say is one of the things you and I have discussed in the past is how too often I think Barry is written as if he's Wally, and he's not Wally. And that felt to me more like a Wally scene than a Barry scene,
yeah.
In my opinion.
Yeah, I can agree with that. Or even, I believe Todd Weber suggested Bart Allen, and I can actually see that.
I know next to nothing about Bart Allen other than his portrayal on Young Justice, so I'll...
That's pretty much dead on.
Okay, right on.
So,
well, then, yeah, I could see that.
I agree with you on that. It just didn't... Barry Allen... I think earnest is the best word to describe Barry
right.
in any portrayal. He should be earnest, and this came off more like a nervous young kid or whatever, you know. I don't know, but it was just different. You know, we'll see how it turns out on the big screen, and they've got a lot of time to tweak things too between
right.
now and then.
Right.
The other thing that gave me pause, though, and this is unlikely to change significantly, I'm not a big fan of the Flash wearing armor.
I'm fine with it for multiple reasons. One, to distinguish it from the CW look, because it's going to be hard, in my opinion, to do that sleek one-piece suit better than the way the TV show does it. And two, it could make for some interesting visualizations in that if it snaps on piece by piece, you might be able to do something kind of like the Flash ring, where he's able to vibrate in and out of the suit or something. So
right.
I think there are some cool possibilities for that. So I actually kind of dig the look of the suit. I think it's very different, but I can see why you might not like it. Honestly, it reminded me most of the suit from the Injustice game.
Yes, and as you may recall, that's one of the few things that I didn't love about Injustice was some of the suits. And
they were all very armored.
Armory. And I don't like armory suits on superheroes unless that's their gimmick.
Right.
So, you know, that's just a style of taste on my end. But we'll see how it turns out when it hits the big screen. Cyborg, we didn't really get to see enough of in this one. Obviously, the CGI is far from polished.
And I was about to say, I think the reason for that is because of the – I mean, they haven't had time to polish CGI.
Right.
I would not be surprised if the only shot of Cyborg we got in that trailer is the only shot of Cyborg that's even close to being finished for the movie.
Right, and that would make sense because that's going to be something they're going to finish up probably towards the end.
Right.
All those effects.
And, again, based on that one preliminary shot, let's hope they're going to do some work on it because it was not impressive in my opinion.
Now,
but that's to be expected.
They did telegraph via a still image the fact that obviously, as we knew, Superman is coming back. Were you surprised they didn't show any Superman in the trailer?
Yes. Or no, excuse me. No, I wasn't surprised by that. I think Russell, as he said on Twitter, our good friend Russell, the host of Sellers Points over there, also here on Place to Be Nation Pop, has pretty much nailed it. I think Superman's role in the movie will be mostly in the third act, and so
yep.
I would be surprised, honestly, if they had shot a ton of Superman stuff at this point.
Yep.
If you remember the reports from the set visit a while back, journalists who were on set did not see Henry Cavill on set. So, you know, it would stand to reason that they may not have even put any Superman footage in the can yet. So,
yeah,
no, not really a surprise to me.
Fair to say.
And I mean, I don't have a problem with them releasing the still image either because I think everybody – I mean, everybody knows he's coming back. I don't think anybody, especially after the grains of dirt hovering over the casket at the end of Batman v Superman, I think no one was laboring under the delusion he wasn't going to appear in this movie.
Right. Now, not to be outdone, Marvel countered Warner Brothers with a full-length trailer, new trailer for Doctor Strange, which is coming out in just a few months. And this finally sold me on this movie.
You were not sold before, huh?
No, not 100%. I because honestly, the first trailer that came out for it, I thought it was cool, but I was like, okay, I understand being influenced by Inception and Batman Begins, but I've already seen Inception and Batman Begins, and I don't want to watch the same movie. They prove with this one it's not going to be the same movie at all. It's going to be its own thing, although it wears its influences on its sleeve. And as I mentioned on Twitter, if you're going to rip off a Nolan movie, Inception and Batman Begins are pretty good places to start. And this looks really good. Really good.
I agree. Showed some of that trade Marvel humor that we didn't get from the first teaser or from the first trailer as well. So I was already in the bag for this movie. I think the special effects look amazing. I'm all for any kind of Inception, Batman Begins love child that this might turn out to be. So they didn't have to sell me any further, but you know, I certainly love the trailer as well.
Yeah, I think the I already gave them the benefit of the doubt. I was going to go see it anyway because it's Marvel and they knock everything out of the park. I was sure that Ant-Man was going to fail and it was really good. So I'm positive this is going to be great. But it's the trailer was awesome and it looks trippy and mind-blowing and gave me the same feeling I had when the trailers for Inception came out back in the day. So big fan of that. Anything else to add on that?
Not really. And then the other trailer that hit that was also a Warner Brothers trailer, but we didn't talk about with the other movies because it's a little bit of a different property. We got our first full-length look at the upcoming Lego Batman movie. Not to be confused with the Lego Batman video games or the straight-to-DVD Lego Batman movies they've been doing over the last few years. This is a Lego Batman movie that spins directly out of the Lego movie that came out a couple years ago. So, Greg, what were your thoughts on this trailer? And did you ever see the Lego movie? Were you aware of – okay, so you were aware of this take on Batman at least prior to the trailer.
Yeah, Will Arnett, I believe. Is that correct?
Yes, Will Arnett, yes.
Yeah, and I love the Lego movie. I thought it was great. Really, really funny. And I loved the first teaser footage that they released of this one. But I've got to be completely honest. I did not like this trailer.
I'm going to hear you out, but I'm going to say it. I'm thinking to myself in my head, I think I know why you didn't like this trailer.
It's probably not the reason you think. It has nothing to do with Dick Grayson.
I'm stunned by that.
Nope, nothing. I couldn't care less. I didn't like this trailer because I didn't find it funny. I just didn't find the jokes funny. Which is weird because I love the Lego movie and I love the teaser footage they released this one, but I thought this one was really light on the humor. And my hope is that that's because they're saving the really good stuff for the movie as opposed to what most people do and they put all the good jokes in the trailer. So I'm still holding out hope for this because I think it has a potential to be really funny, but I gotta admit, I was personally a little let down by this one.
I would actually, you know, say I was the inverse of you on the two Lego Batman trailers we've gotten thus far. I kind of hated the first one. I didn't think it was funny at all, but I kind of enjoyed this one. I thought it had a little bit more going on. I'm down for some Ralph Fiennes voicing Alfred. So I think there are some good things here, and I'm very much looking forward to seeing what comes of this. I don't know that this one's a theatrical watch for me, but it's definitely a rental at some point.
Well, the thing about watching it in the theater is I'll have to wait at least a week or two to see it in the theater because I have to wait for the gigantic kid audience to thin out. So, as you know, watching movies in the theater with small children can be a little distracting.
I'll be honest, I haven't done it in years, so I wouldn't know.
Oh, you haven't taken Olivia to see one yet?
No, Lord, no. I'm not crazy, Greg. if all goes well, I'm probably going to take her to see Wonder Woman next year, and that'll probably be her first big screen outing.
Very good. Very good. Well, we've talked about the movie side here, and
– Well, wait a minute. There's a couple other things on the movie side we should probably touch, especially from the Marvel panel.
A couple of films we didn't get
to see anything from, but we got some casting announcements. And we'll start with the – more high profile one first, and that was the announcement of Brie Larson being officially announced as playing Carol Danvers, aka Captain Marvel. I'll admit I don't know very much about Brie Larson. I know she was in the movie Room, which got a lot of critical acclaim, and
I'll admit I don't know much about Carol Danvers.
Well, that's a fantastic point. But yeah, she's got a lot of critical buzz right now, and so good move by Marvel to pick up a chick who seems to be building quite a reputation for herself as an actress. So I'm excited about that, and honestly, at this point, Marvel has earned the benefit of the doubt so much that I'm not really going to knock anything they do.
I feel like also comic book fans, we are comic book fans. As comic book fans, we all need to take a step back and realize the fact that some of us are complaining about an Academy Award winner playing a superhero in a movie. There was a time when Dolph Lundgren was the only person in Hollywood willing to play a superhero in a movie.
Right.
And Michael Keaton is Batman, obviously. But there was a time when Oscar winners wouldn't touch these movies with a 10-foot pole.
Well,
so, you know,
I think what you're referring to is there was a little bit of controversy that came out of that
because
over the age of Brie Larson, and people there's a certain contingent of fandom who is complaining and saying that Carol Danvers should be someone in her mid to late 30s rather than someone in her early 20s. My counter to that would be that makes sense for a Captain Marvel who spent years as Miss Marvel. I do not get the impression that the Marvel Cinematic Universe is going to say that she was Miss Marvel even for a time. I get the impression that Captain Marvel is going to be the identity she takes on from the beginning, and I think the idea with not only her casting but also the casting of Tom Holland as Spider-Man is to start casting young actors who don't command overly high salaries at the moment so that they can take over as the flagship characters of the MCU once Robert Downey Jr., Chris Evans, Chris Hemsworth, and Mark Ruffalo are ready to step away, whenever that may be. I hope it's not for a long time, but you got to start preparing for the future.
You got to get the next generation ready. I agree. And I think, in fairness, I think part of the issue is that Carol, I don't know anything about her hardly, but my main knowledge of her comes from X-Men comics back in the day when Rogue absorbed her powers. But my understanding is that she served a lot of time in the military, and I think that's one of the issues that people have is that she spent years earning her rank in the military or what have you. So I don't know that for a fact. That's just what I've gathered online. My deal is, you know, I get it. I understand it. But it is an Academy Award winner, an Oscar winner playing a superhero, which is pretty cool. It doesn't happen that often.
And this is a different take. I mean, the Marvel Cinematic Universe has never lifted characters directly as they were from the page.
No, they actually made Tony Stark interesting.
Yes, that's right. They actually made Tony Stark interesting. Hell, I'll say it. They actually made Captain America interesting. They have done things and revamped characters in the areas where they need to, while also maintaining the core of the character. And just my opinion, based on the little Captain Marvel I know, I don't think the core of Carol Danvers is her age. I don't think that is what she is all about.
I agree.
Just my opinion.
I agree. And now let's get to the one that really excites me. Oh my God. So Kurt Russell, we had known for a while, Guardians of the Galaxy 2, Volume 2.
And the rumor was he was going to be playing a character that would eventually be revealed to be the father of Star-Lord, Chris Pratt's character from the first film.
Well, as it turns out, we found out this weekend that he will indeed be playing the father of Star-Lord. And we also found out that the father of Star-Lord is Ego the Living Planet. God, ladies and gentlemen,
I want to be excited about this and love it so much, but I'll be honest. This bothers me in the same way that the Nova Corps working on the big screen before the Green Lantern Corps bothers me.
Call this the MOGO effect?
Yes. When MOGO finally comes, you know, a generation from now to the big screen, people will say, well, it was very reminiscent of Kurt Russell's Ego back in Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, and I'll shake my fist and eat my tapioca pudding from my 75-year-old hands because that's how old I'll be whenever they finally
– on deck.
We own Doug. That's how old whenever they finally make a freaking Green Lantern movie. That's good.
Finally getting a good Green Lantern movie. We own Deck.
We'll die during the trailers before the opening credits ever lift.
But no, I am so pumped for this. Like,
I'm down though. In all honesty, yeah, it looks great. Planet.
And then CBR put up a description from Jack Kirby from about when he invented Ego the Living Planet. If you can find it, look it up, because it's a giant block of text in which Kirby explains what he was thinking when he created Ego the Living Planet, and it's so comic booky and like gobbledygook and awesome, and it's exactly what I want. And and James Gunn is a madman and a genius, and I love him so much for even attempting to do this on the big screen. I can't wait, ladies and gentlemen. Ego, the freaking living planet. Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 at the top of my most anticipated comic book movies list right now, right alongside Black Panther and Wonder Woman.
Yeah, I'm pumped for it as well. One thing that I read was the Newsarama live blog of it. And so apparently at the panel, they showed some footage from Guardians that we haven't gotten released online yet. And apparently, according to Newsarama, there is actually an exchange between Dave Bautista's Drax the Destroyer and Ego the Living Planet, played by Kurt Russell. In that, Kurt Russell was explaining that he created himself a human form so that he could go out and experience life in the universe amongst mortal beings. And that's when he met Star-Lord's mother and wound up, you know, creating Star-Lord. And Drax, of course, being the lover of literality that he is, asked, "Did you make a penis?" "Yes, Drax, I made a penis." That those two lines in the movie, I mean, sells me to a degree that I didn't even need to be sold because I was already pre-sold. You know, it looks fantastic. I can't wait.
Yeah, no, can't wait for that one. Also, Ego has oftentimes traditionally been drawn with a giant mustache, and as we know, nobody in Hollywood wears a giant mustache like Kurt Russell. So,
hell's coming with him.
That's right. Hell's coming with him. Anyway, and from the movie side, we're finally going to get down, I believe, to yes. The TV side, where we also had a deluge of
a slew trailers, man. My lord.
Advertisements for upcoming seasons of a variety of comic book related television series. Where shall we start, Mr. Duke?
Let's take these in inverse order from not excited to most excited. So let's start with a trailer that I haven't even watched yet, but Greg, hit me with a little description of what you saw from the hashtag Gotham Sucks Season 3 trailer.
Yes, well, the hashtag Gotham Sucks Season 3 trailer begins with what appears to be a bunch of shots from hashtag Gotham Sucks Season 2. I know this because it was all, Season 2 was supposedly all about the villains of Gotham. So you see Eddie Nygma.
All of whom are 15 years older than Bruce.
Right.
So by the time Bruce actually becomes Batman, they'll be pushing their middle ages and up into their 50s and 60s.
That's right. So you see Eddie Nygma, and he's behind bars doing weird Jim Carrey faces. And
Did Donald Logue appear to tell him to stop, you know, stop using so many damn riddles, Nygma?
No, but Donald Logue does appear in the background telling Gordon, "You don't have to do it alone, Jim. You're not alone anymore." And Gordon appears to be descending into insanity and crossing the line, which, by the way, he crossed in like the second episode of the show. But now apparently it's a big deal because he's crossed the line again and killed somebody. So he's dealing with the fallout of that. And you see all these different villains. You see Mr. Freeze come in and throw like a freeze bomb, the effects of which look pretty good, I'll admit.
How's the suit look?
They didn't really show the suit that I could tell in the trailer. I haven't watched any of the season
episodes. Wait. So there's a Mr. Freeze that's throwing freeze bombs but isn't wearing the freeze suit?
Well, you caught kind of a glimpse of him, but it was back in the shadows.
Right on,
He appeared in season two, I believe, but I didn't see it, of course, because I haven't, you know, I don't watch
it. And why is that?
Because hashtag Gotham sucks. So you see Freeze, you see the Penguin is getting electroshock therapy.
which I bet gave you a little tingle in the nether regions.
Oh, yes. I could watch that all day long. I'd actually rather see him get beaten with a shovel, but that seems unlikely unless Kevin Costner pops up.
Right.
But there's a and the other big conceit is that Hugo Strange has found a way to bring people back from the dead.
Which is, for the love of God.
Certainly a unique take on Dr. Hugo Strange.
Certainly a unique thing for a freaking Batman television show.
A Batman television show in which there is no Batman yet. So the Gotham TV is going to take
Why do people undead. Watch this show?
I have no
why?
Idea. Well, so anyway, as part of bringing people back from the dead, he has found a way to bring Fish Mooney back from the dead.
For fuck's sake.
To which she utters this immortal line in the trailer. She says, "My name's Fish Mooney, bitch." And then she drives a truck out of there.
Does she have a glass eye?
Yes.
Oh, God. I was joking.
Yep. But then it all culminates at the very end of the trailer. And that you see this owl figure and you start hearing people talking in the background about this mysterious group that's running Gotham behind the scenes. And who are they? Who's behind this? Who are the Court of Owls, Nick?
A version of the Court of Owls that's nothing like the Court of Owls, I'm assuming.
Well, if you like your Court of Owls and your talons, to resemble Dr. Simon Hurt of the Black Glove, then...
Oh, for fuck's sake.
Yep. The very last shot of the trailer is what I'm assuming to be a Talon jumping over a table at Bruce, and he looks almost exactly like Dr. Hurt with the little black mask and everything else.
Fuck this show. Let's move on.
You see, folks, they conflated one of Nick's favorite Batman villainous concepts with Nick's least favorite Batman villainous concept.
Maw.
Indeed. Now, from there, where do you want to go next? Let's go to the FX network. Let's go to
this was interesting. I knew this show was in development, but I haven't been following it at all. And I got to be honest, this trailer hit, and we're talking about FX's Legion, which appears based on the trailer to be loosely tied to the X-Men universe. The trailer certainly intrigued me, but I have not a single clue what this show is actually about.
Yeah, see, it seems kind of muddied because for those that don't know, in the comic books, Legion is
actually...
See,
I know nothing about Legion, so this will be good.
Legion, whose name is David Haller, he is actually the son of Professor Xavier.
Right, I knew that much.
Xavier has had a tryst with Legion's mom and led to Legion. Legion is an extremely powerful mutant.
In the Ultimate Universe, Legion's mom is Moira MacTaggert.
She is not in the 616. His mother in the 616. I'm trying to remember her name. I can't remember her name, but his mother was not Moira in the 616. But he is ridiculously powerful. He's Omega level. What are you laughing
Sorry.
At?
Sorry, that's still like one of the nerdiest things that they ever came up with is, you know, the different words to describe the power level of the mutants. Oh, he's an Omega level mutant.
Hey, that's how you separate the cream of the crop, the wheat from the chaff. What's wrong with that?
It's over 9,000.
Well, he's an Omega level mutant, like Iceman and others. Not many others, but others.
So if Legion and Iceman are Omega level, what does that make Apocalypse?
Well, Apocalypse has his own category. Apocalypse has all sevens on the back of the Marvel card, Nick.
Is seven the highest you can obtain?
Seven is the highest you can obtain. He actually
not ten. These don't go to 11.
No, these went to seven. He didn't actually have all sevens, but he should have had all sevens because there was no way to beat him, really. He's just ridiculously – I've pulled up his Wikipedia, and I will attempt to read to you his power set. He's an Omega –
Legion or Apocalypse?
Legion. He is an Omega-level mutant who has multiple personalities. The first personality to manifest was the mind of a terrorist that David somehow absorbed into himself. According to Karma, who's another character, the only way he can absorb other people into his mind is if he is right next to them when they die. Or through telepathy. So basically, he absorbs people's psyches into him,
right.
And when he does,
he has them all bouncing around in his head.
Exactly. So he's completely nuts.
Which that's what I mean. Judging by the trailer, it seemed like one of the heavy themes they were going to lean into is the how people are supposed to deal with mental illness. So I mean, it seems like a superhero take on the issue of mental illness, essentially.
Right, and that's the one thing I was going to say. This trailer looked awesome. Would you not agree? Like the production
it was shot amazingly, and it looked like a piece of art, essentially.
Absolutely.
That was coming out at times. My problem with it is, like I said,
I have no idea what the hell's
going on. No idea what's happening. Like, even the trailer stops. This is just the trailer. So I have no idea what they're going to do in the actual show. But there is a moment where the trailer comes to a grinding halt for a bizarre dance scene. That makes no sense, and they just move on past it like it never happened.
There are no flags.
Indeed. It's one of the most bizarre things, but hey, at the very least, it piqued my interest. I'm at least going to give the pilot a shot now and see if it hooks me or not.
And I think there's potential here to do a show in which even the viewer is not sure if he's really a mutant or if he's crazy.
That's a good point. I know you've always loved that take on characters, specifically the ultimate version of Thor.
It's
been one of your favorites.
I loved that version of Thor. Not to the point that I preferred him to the 616, but just that I really appreciated how they went for it with that and did something different. And I think I do think that there's field, or there's, I can't even know, think of the word that I'm trying to grab here, but there is certainly an ability to draw that out. There's potential there. That's the word. My God, I couldn't think of the word potential. Folks, I'm just going to lay out for the rest of this episode.
Well, so anyway, with all that being said about Legion, let's move over to, you know, we had a series of trailers from two very distinct universes, and I'm going to – let's start with the one that, in my opinion, was just a little bit less impressive than the other one. Not that these weren't impressive, and let's talk about the first clips and sizzle reels we got for upcoming season of DC television on CW shows. Those, of course, being Arrow, Flash, and Legends. And let's start with Legends, which probably had the least amount of new footage to show off. We got a sizzle reel that was mostly clips from season one spliced together, but we did get a little glimpse of some more Hourman in season. It's going to be in season two as part of the Justice Society, and also something that was recently revealed. We got a look at Damian Dark as a member of the Legion of Doom. And that's right, a version of the Legion of Doom is coming as the main antagonist to the Justice Society in Legends of Tomorrow Season 2. And I, for one, cannot wait. It gave us this sizzle reel gave us Damian Dark in bowler hat, which, given Neil McDonough's previous performance in the MCU, I'm pretty sure we need to refer to him as Dumb Dumb Dark from now on.
That's right, and it opens up a world of possibilities with regards to seeing the rest of the Legion of Doom in historical garb. Perhaps Malcolm Merlyn wearing a bustier or dressing like broken Matt Hardy, for instance.
Oh, that would be awesome. That would be awesome. Or the Reverse Flash in like uncomfortable 1800s Western leather instead of sleek yellow futuristic leather.
Ooh. Yes, I like the potential here. There's just a ton of potential with this show in general, and they didn't give us much new footage, so it's hard to comment on. But what they gave us looked promising. Looked promising. I have
and
to
had
say.
And had a pretty emotional punch to it with the idea of Sarah getting to face down her sister's future killer.
Absolutely, and that's going to be cool. And we are getting the Legion of Doom, but I was a little disappointed. No Hawk, no Animal, no Paul Ellering thus far.
Well, fortunately, however, there's going to be Woody the Dummy. Is that his name?
Rocco the Dummy.
Rocco, that's right. My mistake. But Rocco is there, so that's a positive.
That's true. That was one of the big surprise casting announcements. Is that he's actually going to be in the show? So
and also Tammy Sitch reprising her role from LOD 2000.
Oh, hopefully not in the same attire, but at this point.
Well, at the very least, it's got to be better than her last acting project.
Yo, we're moving on to moving on from that to the longest running weekly episodic
DC television show on the CW.
That being, of course, since Smallville went off the air, and that would be
Smallville is WB though,
but it switched over to CW.
Yes, but the WB was a network wholly owned by Warner Brothers, whereas the CW is a co-founded joint production between CBS and Warner Brothers, thus a distinct entity unto itself.
That's right. We'll claim it the way that Vince can claim things for Raw. So
we're good at claiming things, especially since we are the longest running weekly comic book podcast in Place to Be Nation pop history.
That's correct. And don't you forget it out there. In any event, we are talking about Arrow. Arrow season 5 is coming up, coming off a bit of a rocky second half of season 4 and needing to kind of get back in the right direction. Nick, I'll start with you as opposed to me. What did you think of the season 5 trailer? I just realized there's only two people on this podcast. So,
right. What been a while, hadn't it?
It has, yeah. What did you think of the season 5 trailer for our beloved show, Arrow?
Hey, man, I liked it. It looked like the threats that are being presented in this season are going to be back to being street-level, grounded, crime-based threats, which is what Arrow has always been best at. And yes, I recognize the hypocrisy in me saying that, seeing as how I'm someone who loved the hell out of the League of Assassins season.
Mm-hmm.
But I mostly liked the introduction of the new members of the team, Wild Dog and Vigilante. I liked the shot we got of Felicity and Thea. I don't remember a shot of Diggle, which gives me some concern.
Yeah, I noticed that too.
I did not get the impression. Now, granted, they don't want to give everything away in the trailer for sure, but the interplay between Oliver and Felicity certainly made it seem like they were just best pals and really ignoring everything that, you know, had come before, which frustrates me. But I did read somewhere where Grant Gustin was saying that apparently the plan is for Flashpoint over on Flash to have an impact on the CW shows in some way. Mm. So I'm wondering how that's going to affect Arrow and for how long.
And
but overall,
right.
I really, really liked the trailer. I think it looks like a return to form for Arrow, particularly from an action standpoint. One thing that was a little confusing to me, and I want to get your take on this. I don't know if you read, the comic book websites were picking up news and reporting that the trailer confirmed Prometheus as the big bad for Arrow Season 5. And that may have been said of the panel, but I don't see how you watch that trailer and go, oh, that's Prometheus.
Yeah, it was so dark and it was so hard to tell what was going on that it was difficult for – I mean, I honestly didn't know who it was when I was watching it. Now, I don't have the strongest familiarity with Prometheus. I'm familiar with him mainly from a Green Arrow appearance, but – You know, I didn't think Prometheus when I saw it. I was like, who is that?
The idea of Prometheus, as I understand it, is that he started out as a Batman villain who was the child of criminals, and his parents were killed by two policemen. And so he becomes the inverse of Batman, where he dedicates himself to crime and the destruction of the Batman rather than Bruce's, you know, dedication to upholding law and order and stamping out organized crime in Gotham.
If I'm not mistaken, he's a Morrison character, right? I thought Morrison created him for JLA.
I believe that is the case, yeah, from back in the 90s. And this show, you know, Arrow has a tradition of taking Batman villains and repurposing them for Arrow. So I'm intrigued to see what their take on Prometheus is. You know, I certainly know who I would have underneath the Prometheus hood, but that's another topic for another day, I'm afraid.
I know where you're going, sir. I know where you're going. And actually, yes, assuming this is the second Prometheus, he was created by Grant Morrison in 1998. I believe that is the Prometheus version they're going to go with. So, yeah, very interesting. I liked the trailer, too. I thought it was promising. You know, it didn't blow me away, but it...
Nope.
It gave me hope for the next season, and
it just had very much a back to basics feel about it. Like,
yeah, and it anchored itself on Ollie and how Ollie is dealing with things. And I think that's one of the major things the show has got to get back to, is it's got to get back to centering on Oliver Queen as opposed to centering on every other character but Oliver Queen. So
agreed completely. And so the last CW show that had a trailer, and probably the best of the
yes.
I don't think there's any doubt, the best of the CW trailers we got to see was first look at Flash Season 2, or Season 3, excuse me. And this looked very good. It was mostly a look at the Flashpoint storyline, which they have confirmed. Well, they haven't confirmed anything, but they have said will not take up as much of the season as you might think. So it's possible that this is only really a trailer for the first 5 or 6 episodes of the season rather than the season as a whole.
Yeah. But it looked phenomenal, man. You can tell they're dealing with the ramifications of what Barry did, because his relationships have changed. The people around him have changed. The situation around him has changed. And I think he's going to realize before too long that these changes, while on the surface they seem better, they're actually not.
Exactly. And let me offer my official prediction. The person that is going to make him realize that he has to go back and set things the way they were isn't going to be Iris this time. I think it's going to be Joe. I think, judging by the trailer, my prediction is that Joe is going to be in a much worse place than he was in Barry's usual timeline, and that Barry is going to feel directly responsible for that and make the determination that he has to set things right so that Joe can be the man he knows he can be, essentially.
I think you're probably right. I think there's a good chance of that. So,
and honestly, I'm excited about that, because I think, in my opinion, the Barry-Joe dynamic is, next to the Barry-Harrison-Wells dynamic, the most interesting part of Flash.
Agreed. absolutely agreed, because they're the two best actors on the three best actors on the show. So
absolutely.
I mean, yeah.
Although I am looking forward to rich douchebag Cisco in a way that I probably shouldn't be.
That's going to be really good. That was one of the, I think that was the funniest part of the trailer, is like, not only that he's playing a rich douchebag, that the attire that they have given him is, or the look that they have given him is of like an 80s rich douchebag.
Yes.
Which is phenomenal.
Yes.
He looks like,
which makes
like
so much sense for the
scene.
And it makes so much sense for the character of Vibe too, like a relic from the 80s essentially. So
yep.
I'm pumped for it, man. But let's talk about, you know, a series of trailers from a universe that I thought pretty much stole the television side of Comic-Con, and that was the Marvel Netflix offerings just dropping amazing trailer after amazing trailer. It was a three-way sucker punch of just awesome that they dropped on us this past Friday. So, Greg, I mean, where do you want to start? Let's start with the one – how about we start with the one that showed the least, and that was we got our first teaser trailer for The Defenders, as well as a confirmation that 2017 will see the release of the Defenders miniseries. And for those who are unaware, that's the combination of Luke Cage, Iron Fist, Jessica Jones, and Daredevil coming together in one show.
Yeah, super pumped for this, obviously. They got us exactly where they want us in terms of being in anticipation of this, being on the edge of our seats, being ready for what's to come. But I have to also say that it got me a little worried about how we're going to get there, because I feel like there's more story to tell, and I don't know if we've got enough time to get there by 2017.
I think that's a legitimate concern. My assumption would be, and this is just my assumption, so later this year in September, we're going to get Luke Cage. Netflix has said they're going with a two show a year model when it comes to these Marvel shows. So I'm thinking Luke Cage in September, Iron Fist in the traditional springtime release date that Daredevil has occupied the last 2 years. And then next fall will probably be Defenders, or at least unless they go to a three show a year model, I don't see any other way that it works, honestly.
Yeah. So it's going to be interesting to watch going forward. But let's get into the meat of it. Let's get into the real trailers that we got. And that would be the upcoming Luke Cage and then Iron Fist trailers. And we'll start off with Luke, because right on the horizon.
Yeah.
Phenomenal trailer.
Oh my God, dude. It was so good.
The filmic choices they made, the tonal choice of the show looks different, man. Looks exactly what it needs to look.
You know, Greg, I don't know if you remember this, but back in our second episode, I think it was, I gave you a little musical challenge.
I don't remember that.
You don't remember the infamous Bill Cosby singing Shane McMahon's theme song?
Oh yes.
I got a new one for you based on this trailer.
Oh, what is it going to be, Nick? I don't know. Let's see.
I wonder what it would sound like if, you know, good old JR hit us with a little taste of the Wu-Tang Clan's Raw.
Oh, baby, I like it raw. Oh, baby, I like it raw. Oh, baby, I like it raw. Oh, baby, I like it raw. There, you happy? I said it. Stupid
song. Oh my God, that, you need to recut the trailer with that instead of the Wu-Tang Clan.
So you could have gone any direction with that, because I thought you were gonna go Vince and say, "Oh baby, I like it." Rah! But you opted not to, so you know,
then drop in a little, it's uncut, uncooked, and uncensored.
Uncensored. Or it's uncut, uncorked, and uncensored, yeah.
But in all seriousness, the Cage trailer was awesome, man. Like the Wu-Tang music set over this cool action scene just gave it a different vibe than either Daredevil or Jessica Jones had. It seems like it's going to be the most fun of the Netflix shows thus far, which isn't to say it doesn't have its dramatic moments. It certainly looks like it's going to lean heavy into the, you know, the grimmer, darker stuff at times, but it also looks like it's going to have an aura of self-awareness about it that the other shows don't seem to have.
Yes, and also it looks street appropriate. Like, it looks gritty. It looks stylish. It looks not unlike what you might find in a street level comic book.
Right.
So very, very happy with.
And it has Barney from Silence of the Lambs.
Does it really?
Yes. The guy who he's talking to at the beginning of the trailer played Barney in Silence of the Lambs, if I'm not mistaken.
Mm. Quite interesting. Now,
and also the landlord from Coming to America.
Well, that guy's awesome. I mean, let's go ahead and say it. That guy is awesome. Now, I wonder if we could connect Barney to Reginald Vell Johnson.
Oh.
That's another challenge for another day, perhaps. But that leads us into the other Marvel Netflix trailer, which also delivered Iron Fist. And,
yes.
And folks, I've never read an Iron Fist comic in my life, full disclosure.
And yet you are a mark for the concept.
Yes. There is not a – we've talked before about how Daredevil as a series is one of the most four Nick Duke concepts that has ever been made on television. Well, Iron Fist is one of the most four Greg Phillips things that has ever been produced on television. I am a sucker for martial arts stuff. Hong Kong movies from the 70s, the cornier, the cheesier, the better. I like the overdubs too. I don't even care for the subtitles. I want the overdubbed bad voices that don't match the words. I want the guy with the long beard and the white eyes. You know, I want all that stuff. And I love those movies to death. I love martial arts action movies. Van Damme, to a much lesser extent, Steven Seagal. Bruce Lee, of course. So the idea of a Marvel show that is marrying the martial arts Hong Kong chop suey style of cinema with the mystical side of the more out there Hong Kong movies of the 70s, love, cannot wait. And bring it into the Marvel universe, are you kidding me? You kidding me? Good Lord! Looks awesome.
It looks very good. I can't disagree with any of that. We didn't see as much as I probably would have liked, but I'm assuming that's because they haven't shot a ton. So I can't complain too much. But I'd say looks really good, and you know, I'm not pre-sold the way you are, but I'm certainly now more excited than I was previously. Let's put it that way. So
yeah, but
we'll see. You know, we'll see what comes of it. But I think there's lots of reason to be excited here.
Totally. And we've hit a lot of television and movies, including the upcoming In Like Flint reboot. However, we haven't touched on actual comic books, and that's because there wasn't a whole lot coming out of this, quite frankly.
No, as we said earlier, the con has kind of been taken over, you know, by Hollywood, essentially. So the con is not where you get your the most of your actual comic book news anymore.
Right. And frankly, New York Comic Con lately has been dropping more bombshells, I feel like, than San Diego has at times, but as far as comics go. But we did get a few.
Greg, wait. I got one thing I want to tell you.
Yeah.
We were just talking about Barney, correct?
Mm-hmm.
You know, Barney, Frankie Faison is the actor's name. He was in The Silence of the Lambs with Anthony Hopkins, correct?
Right, yep.
And I don't know if you're aware of this, but Anthony Hopkins was in the film Red 2 with Bruce Willis.
I was not aware of that.
And I don't know if he was in – I don't know if you know this, but Bruce Willis was in this little film.
Might have heard of it.
Called Die Hard. And in that film, one of his esteemed co-stars was –
Reginald Vell Johnson.
Absolutely. Anyway, continue.
Amazing. So we just connected in a roundabout way Reginald Vell Johnson to the character of Luke Cage.
Yeah, I don't see any other way to look at that. That's the only way Luke Cage could be better, if it was Reginald Vell Johnson running around screaming Sweet Christmas.
Harriet!
And Jessica Jones goes, "My name is Jessica. Your name is Harriet."
McCarroll. Oh Lord.
Oh, and don't forget the grandmother, who's the only who would instantly become the only person in comics history older than Aunt May.
Now, would there be dust Yes.
Yes, there would be.
For another time. So let's get into the comic book world real quick. We're going to hit you with a couple of comic book guys we want to talk about. We'll have more in the coming weeks that came out of here that we'll talk about. But first of all, probably the biggest news coming out of Marvel.
I don't think there's any doubt. This is probably the biggest comic book directly related news because Marvel confirmed their next big event, which, you know, that's the one thing we've talked about is we're kind of fed up with Marvel's approach of just almost at this point, there are no breaks between events,
no breaks.
Really.
Because Event.
Civil War II is not going to wrap up until September. There are still going to be Civil War II tie-ins publishing into October. And then in December, based on my ending, they're going right into their next event.
It feels impenetrable from an
outside perspective. It really does, yeah.
But in any event, we're getting the illustrious...
The long-awaited showdown.
Showdown between the X-Men versus Inhumans. This is the big event coming up. Remember, we got Avengers versus X-Men a few years ago. Well, now we're getting X-Men versus Inhumans. And I don't have a lot to add to that.
Oh, you're not Team Black Bolt, Greg?
I'm not Team Black Bolt. I'm not Team Lockjaw. I'm not Team Medusa. I'm not Team...
Karnak.
Crystal. Human Torch is with them now too, right?
Yeah, he's with them. Yeah, that's true.
I don't.
Ulysses.
All I know is I want the X-Men to clean house. I want the X-Men to win in a sweep, and I want it to be my X-Men. You know, time displaced Cyclops and time displaced Jean Grey and time displaced Logan and time displaced Cable. And I want it to be all of these time displaced characters I love.
Well, you know, Greg, as you know, our listeners will hear in just a few short weeks, there's a passionate argument to be made for time displaced characters being completely different characters than characters they share identities with.
We're getting deep into the weeds on this, Nick. We're breaking the space-time continuum.
We're reaching into the future.
But I don't know. They're trying to get me to buy into the Inhumans, and it's not working. I'm resisting.
One aspect of this I'll give Marvel credit for is Axel Alonso finally came out and said, you know, essentially, yes, we're aware of all the internet rumor about us, you know, shunting the X-Men down the card, so to speak, in favor of the Inhumans because of the film thing. And he's like, I'm not saying that that's true, but what I'm saying is if that perception is out there, why not play off of it and why not feed into it and why not, you know, use it to market? And that's what they're doing. They're trying to drum up interest. Granted, it's a fear-based level of interest, I think, from people like yourself by using that internet speculation.
Well, I mean, it's not going to make me buy the book. I will wait to hear what other people say about it after the fact, as I do with most of the big Marvel events. But here's the thing, though. I get it. Let me tell you what it feels like to me. It feels like they're going to use this event to get heel heat on the Inhumans to set up the big X-Men comeback in the next. I believe this is just the first of two X-Men versus Inhumans battles. Correct.
Yes, apparently there was an 8-month time jump after the events of last year's Secret Wars 2015, if you will, during which there was a Inhumans versus X-Men battle of some sort, and that the story of that will finally be told in the coming months in an event called – or not an event, but a limited series called Death of X. So Death of X takes place in the past, and then Inhumans versus X-Men will be the present-day version of that conflict continuing, I suppose.
Yeah, so I feel like they're going to get a lot of heat on Inhumans, and then they'll probably have the X-Men come back and win it just to assuage us angry fanboys. So, I'm not into it. Can't get into it. I'm sorry. If it were X-Men versus an interesting group of people, then yes.
X-Men versus the Fantastic Four, you mean?
Oh, God. Oh, Lord. Now you're getting me in between a rock and a hard place, Nick. Well, and the other news on the other end of the spectrum, on the complete opposite.
This isn't even really news. It's just something that happened that, like, Greg and I thought was funny, so we're going to talk about it because it's our show and not yours. So, okay.
Yep. Many of you in comic book land and listener land in Larryland, may be familiar with the writer Garth Ennis. Famous.
We talked about him extensively in a countdown of our top five preacher characters that represents, to this point, a moral low bar for our program.
That's correct. Perhaps only equaled by the song At a Medium Pace.
Or discussion of Angry Rice.
Right, which we swore never to speak of again.
You swore.
Well, Mr. Ennis is famous, of course, for Preacher, for Hitman, for Punisher Max.
The Boys.
The Boys, for all these classic seminal works that all seem to share one, similarity amongst them.
Brutal violence and dark humor.
Yep. Brutal violence and dark humor. So imagine our surprise and our reaction when we heard that DC has announced that Garth Ennis will be the author, if you will, of Dastardly and Muttley, an upcoming series based on the villainous Dick Dastardly and his canine sidekick, Muttley, from the classic cartoons of Hanna-Barbera.
This is among the most bizarre pairings of writer and character I've ever heard of in comics, and I don't think that's an overstatement at all.
No, I think bizarre is a very good word for it. And can I be honest? My first reaction was, there is no way this is not going to be awesome on some level. I don't know what that level is, but on some level, whether it is intentionally over the top and Garth Ennis-y, or whether it is unintentionally over the top and Garth Ennis-y, it's gonna be something worth remembering.
Undoubtedly. The only concern I have is it goes back to something you and I have discussed off air about this Hanna-Barbera line of DC books is, who is the target audience for this? Exactly. Like, even our generation, we grew up in an era where the Hanna-Barbera characters were starting to fall out of favor and starting to fall into relative obscurity.
Mainly we saw them through Cartoon Network reruns.
Through Cartoon Network, yeah. And so, obviously, with it being freaking Garth Ennis writing this, it's not going to be aimed at young children, I wouldn't think. Is it aimed at us? Is it aimed at people older than us? Who is the audience for this?
And there you have my Muttley laugh.
That's much better than the ones he tried during the warm-up period.
I was warming up, folks, before the show to try my Muttley laugh, and it wasn't working. I don't know. It's going to be interesting, though. I hope that it's just hilarious. That's what I'm hoping for. But we'll see how it turns out.
It's one of those things that's so bizarre that I'm at least going to have to check it out. Like, I'm at least going to have to pick up an issue and see what it is and how it works.
How bizarre.
And one thing I'm kind of hoping for is that, and you know, granted, I would imagine that Muttley isn't hoping for this, but I think there's an opportunity here to cross over with a certain Preacher character who has a certain penchant for, you know, fancying the animals there. I think bringing TC over to do a little guest spot on Dastardly and Muttley might not be the worst idea in the world.
Low-grade narcolepsy and a penchant for buggery. In any event, this brings to an end an exceedingly long opening segment here of the Hard Traveling Fanboys.
Yes, remember how last week when we went to this new format, we promised you it was an attempt to get to the meat of the show a little bit quicker. We lied completely.
In our defense, San Diego Comic-Con turned things on their head.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and as a result, we haven't even gotten to reading and watching yet, folks, but we've got to take a break. And when we come back from that break, we're going to hit you with a very, very brief reading-watching. And then we're going to follow that up with our countdown of the top five legacy characters in all of comics. Stay with us, folks, right after this.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly. Make sure you check out every episode of The Kevin Kelly Show right here on the Place to Be Nation. PlaceToBeNation.com, The Kevin Kelly Show. Every episode is a winner. At least we hope.
Place to Be Nation's Justin Rosero here. In addition to the Kevin Kelly Show, we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. And we now offer them to you on two great feeds as well. On the Place to Be podcast feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, with our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with clotheslines and headlines, main event, Mission Indie Possible, in our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on WWE, NXT, and Ring of Honor Super shows. Relive Wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse and the Dangerous Alliance Wrestling Podcast as we dive into various subjects in the form of exercises and games. We also have sports covered too with the Sports Lounge, the TJ McClune Show, and NBA Team Podcast. On our brand new PTB Pop podcast feed, we offer great shows such as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, and Imaginary Stories. Subscribe to both feeds on iTunes and be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows are available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to check out on the right-hand side of the site for details on how to support the site when you shop at Amazon and download our free Place to Be Vintage Vault Refresh eBooks. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, in Fall River, Massachusetts, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
This is Parv, and I'm here to tell you to listen and subscribe to the pro wrestling only Place to Be Nation podcast network. That's the PWO PTBN podcast network, where you'll find a ton of in-depth shows done by hardcore fans. We've got Chris Zellner's 1-2 Punch of Exile on Bad Street, and with David Bickenspan, a smash hit Between the Sheets. We've got Wrestling Culture with Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave, Goodwill Wrestling and the reaction shows with good old Will from Texas. We've got This Week in Wrestling with my man Pete and Johnny Sorrow, Stephen Graham and Tim Livingston's Pro Wrestling Super Show, Tag Team's Back Again with Kelly and Marty Sleaze, and a ton of other great shows too. And of course, there's Titans of Wrestling and Where the Big Boys Play with yours truly and some dude from down south called Chad. PWO, PTBN, Podcast Network.
Tell me where to go, tell me what to do. I'll be right there for you. Tell me what to say, no matter if it's true. I'll say it all for you, for you.
I used to be the type of kid that would always think the sky is falling. Why am I so differently wired? Am I a Martian? What kind of twisted experiment am I involved in? Cause I don't belong in this world. That's why I'm scoffing at authority, defiant often. Flying off at the handle at my mom, no dad, so I am non-compliant at home.
We're back, ladies and gentlemen, and I don't need for no the second half. Hard Traveling Fanboys Countdown.
And we're still in the opening.
That's right. We're still in the opening, folks. It's Countdown. Countdown, the show where we count down things, and we can't even count them down yet because we're not finished with our opening segment. So we're going to try to make this one brief. I didn't watch Preacher this week. My DVR failed to record it because Time Warner Cable is run by Satan himself. Nick did watch Preacher, however, we're going to hold off talking about it. I watched Batman the Killing Joke at the movie theater, and I am going to hold off talking about that because we have a special episode planned about that once the DVD comes out. I will just say, I loved the adaptation. I did not love the new stuff, and we'll get to that at a later time. Now, let's get into what you're reading. Nick, what you're reading?
Continuing our format from last week, where we're going to attempt to give you our top three books of the week and our bottom one. Do we want to start bottom or top this week?
I like the idea of starting bottom.
Starting bottom. We're going to start at the bottom. And for me, this is a week where it was tough because I didn't have any books like last week where, I mean, you know, I wasn't a huge fan of Nightwing Rebirth last week. But this week, I thought all the books were at least decent. But if I'm going to pick a bottom book, I'm going to go with Green Lanterns number 3 as my bottom book of the week. And the reasoning for this is, Greg and I, you and I have discussed off air, what works about this book right now is the characterizations of Simon Baz and Jessica Cruz and their respective interplay with one another.
Mm-hmm.
What doesn't work about the book is damn near everything else, honestly. With the exception of the art. The art has been pretty good the first two issues and in the Rebirth special. Here in issue 3, I think the art slipped considerably, and also I thought the writing of Atrocitus and Bleez in particular, and most of the Red Lanterns, was so on the nose and just kind of over the top in a way that doesn't seem to fit the story. Add to the fact that, like, I continue to not have a clue as to what is even going on with the Red Lanterns, how they became, how they suddenly got reset to status quo with no real transition from where they were at the end of the Red Lanterns ongoing during the New 52. And, you know, gotta pick a bottom book. I'm gonna go with Green Lanterns. This one is still on my pull list as of the moment, but I will say, if we have more books that come along that kind of catch me by surprise by how good they are, this one starts to move towards the dangerous cut line for me.
Yeah, and, you know, I can't argue too vociferously with any of that. I liked it a little bit more than you did, but I think what's working, as you mentioned, Simon and Jessica, love it. Their dynamic is what's going to keep me buying this book. It's not in danger of being dropped by me by any means, but the Red Lantern stuff bothers me. There's also one line.
Oh, yeah. I didn't even think about that. Yeah.
Uttered by Simon Baz that stuck in my Green Lantern fanboy craw just a little bit. And I'll tell you what it is. There's a point in the comic, and I don't have it here right next to me, but so I'm going off of memory, where he's using his ring to try and cleanse Bleez of the red infection, of the rage that has consumed her. And it works temporarily. Well, after it, he kind of collapses and he says a simple line of dialogue that flies in the face of the most important Green Lantern story. He says, "This is the first time the ring has ever hurt me." And that, ladies and gentlemen, flies in the face directly of a line that we praised a few podcasts ago with Jennifer Smith when we were reviewing the Long Book Hunters. When we were doing the Long Book Hunters to review Green Lantern Rebirth from 2005, and that line was when Kyle Rayner told Oliver Queen that the ring hurts every single time you use it.
Absolutely.
That you focus your will through it. And that little line stuck in my craw after reading the issue. I still enjoyed the issue. I love the character dynamics, the interplay between Simon and Jessica. Their characters are awesome, but that bothered me.
And I agree. It bothered me as well.
But
you know, I don't want to pile on the book too much, because like I said, I still think it was a decent enough book. It's just, for me, it's my bottom book of the week. So, Greg, first of all, before we move into your bottom of the book of the week, did you read everything?
No, I did not read everything. I was about to say that. I have not read Aquaman yet. Aquaman number 3, I believe it is. I have not read Action Comics yet.
Well, that's convenient because Action Comics didn't come out last week.
Oh, well, that's good then. I've caught up on Action Comics then. And I did not read Batman yet. So Aquaman and Batman I've not read. And I haven't read Birds of Prey either, or The Hellblazer. So I've got a lot that I haven't read. Which is good for our purposes this week. So if I had to pick a worst book of the ones that I did read last week, I am actually going to go with one. It's hard for me to pick because I thought all of them were good. I'm going to go with Justice League number 1. I'm not going to pile on it for being bad because it was actually good. It was a big step up from Justice League Rebirth. I did not think it was as good as Green Lanterns, so I can't put Green Lanterns on the bottom, but this was better. The art was significantly better here. The story was more coherent. It seemed like there was more going on. There were more character beats going on. Dialogue was sharper. Still not great, but better. And again, the art was so much better in this. Tony Daniel drew it. Brian Hitch wrote it. Thumbs up for Justice League, but still probably the worst of the ones that I read last week. But still, very good.
I had Justice League just above Green Lanterns on my list, so came that close. And I will say, you know, trying to keep this brief, so I will say this: it was good enough to buy it another issue, but it's going to have to improve.
Yes,
in order to maintain a long term spot on my pull list.
Yes, I agree with that.
Better than the Rebirth issue, but that's not exactly
still a real endorsement. A good comic, But in this initiative, you can't just be a good comic.
Exactly. So let's move into our top three of the week. Or do we want to do our quick hits first?
Let's move into our top because I'm only going to have a few to talk about anyway. So
awesome. All right. Well, for me, and this comes as a shock to no one, I'm going to go at number three with a book you haven't read yet. So I'll keep my comments brief. I'm going Aquaman number three. This deals in large part with the fallout from issue two that saw, you know, Black Manta's attack on the Atlantean embassy. And what happens is the U.S. government declares the embassy essentially a crime scene slash war zone and denies the Atlanteans re-entry to their own embassy. So the issue is actually essentially a issue that deals with surface Atlantis diplomacy, including Aquaman and Mira making a trip to the White House, which is a cool scene. And so it kind of sets up what looks to be the theme of the book going forward, which is Aquaman trying to find legitimacy and acceptance on the surface world, not as a human, but as a political head of state. So interesting dynamic for that book going forward. I can't wait to hear your thoughts on it next week. And that's all I'll say in the interest of spoilers.
Yeah, and I guess I'll move on to Green Lanterns number three. I've pretty much already touched on it. I'll just say I enjoy the interplay.
Oh, so that's your number three book of the week, huh?
Yes.
Okay.
Of the ones that I've read. Jessica and Simon, outstanding together. I love the fact finally gave Simon something to do. As you know, that's been one of my complaints about it thus far, is that it's felt not this bad thing, but it's felt like a Jessica book instead of a Simon book or a Simon and Jessica book. And I think Jessica has shown at the expense of Simon, and I like the fact that they finally gave him an issue to really show out. So that's my number, my whatever number it is, number three, I guess you would say.
Gotcha. My number two book of the week is actually a Marvel title. It's a Star Wars Marvel title, and that is Darth Vader number 23. We are continuing to hurtle thrillingly towards the conclusion of the series. We've got events being, you know, paid off in big ways. We've got cool lightsaber battles. We've got the breakout character, or one of the breakout characters of this book, in my opinion, Dr. Aphra, continuing to have really, really cool moments. You've got the murder droids, as they're so lovingly called, continuing to steal nearly every scene they're in. This is an outstanding book. I don't want to see it end. And honestly, one of my favorite things about this book is the cover they show you to 24 in the back of the book as a preview, and it's the most heartbreaking cover images I've seen from this series. It basically shows what looks like Vader having a hallucination of Padme before him, and Pad turning her back on him because of what he's become. And it's a – even though you can't see his face – there's so much emotion portrayed in the way he holds his body that it makes me even more excited for 24 coming up. But 23 itself was an outstanding book. I can't wait for you to one day read this book because I think you are going to love it as a Star Wars fan.
So that sounds interesting. How much – is this the last issue or how many more issues?
That was 23. We got 24 and 25, and 25 I believe is a 60-page spectacular that's going to wrap up in August.
Or is it a 60-page spectacular?
Spectacular is actually trademarked by Glenn Butler and Plays to Be Nation Pop.
Well, that's good. Maybe we'll get some, you know, maybe we get a little bit of that revenue coming in. That'd be good.
Yes.
So moving on to my number two book of the week, I am going to go with Green Arrow. This is actually from the previous week, I believe, but Green Arrow number three, which I finally got around.
This is from last week. Green Arrow number three.
Okay, good. I'm so confused with my books because I was behind, as you know. I'll go with Green Arrow number three. Enjoyed this one. Continues to propel the story forward. I will say there was a little bit of clunky dialogue in there, particularly when Oliver confronted the head of his corporation who was wearing the mask. He says something to the, you know, some kind of corny line to the extent of, you know, I thought you were my friend or I thought you were my supporter, but you were actually wearing a mask the whole time. I thought that was a little on the cheesy side, but overall, very good story. The story is awesome. Shadow's development continues to be interesting. Amico continues to be interesting. The artwork was, to me, not what I was looking for. I prefer Otto Schmidt, but Otto Schmidt had the week off, and until Otto Schmidt returns, we're going to have to deal with this guy. And he wasn't horrible. It just wasn't what I was looking for. I know you disagree with me, but I I missed the presence of Otto Schmidt, and I'm looking forward to when he returns.
Let's get right into that, because my number one book of the week was Green Arrow number 3. So I actually like the art a little bit better, and my reasoning for liking the art a little bit better, I'll admit, is a completely biased reason. I have a deep emotional attachment to Kevin Smith run on Green Arrow, and I feel like this Juan Ferreira art is very reminiscent of the art style that was used during that book. It looks more like classic Ollie rather than an amalgamation of a New 52 Ollie and classic Ollie, kind of like Otto Schmitz does. And so that's why I like this better. And also, that's something I have discussed off air, the reveal of the Ninth Circle's true nature is a concept that I love, because it's hard to think of a villainous concept that is more fitting for a Green Arrow adversary than the concept they reveal, which I won't spoil. So I loved everything about this book. Green Arrow, to me, Green Arrow and Aquaman thus far are the ongoing titles of Rebirth. They are far and away the books I look forward to the most every time, every other week, every time they come out. So loved Green Arrow 3. And so let's hear your top book of the week, which I think I know where you're going.
You do, because my favorite books of the Rebirth Initiative, the ones that I look forward to the most, are Action Comics and Superman. And Superman number 3 came out last week and was my book of the week. And honestly, it was not very close, to at least for the ones that I've read. It was not close. So this is a book that just continues to wow me. Maybe a smidge off from issue 2, but still very good. And reintroducing the Eradicator into the DCU is a good thing, in my opinion. I have a strong emotional attachment to the original Eradicator story from, I believe, 1990. And this was a cool way to bring the character back. And also, the most important thing to understand about this book is it appears to be more about Jonathan Kent's development than it is about actually Superman and what, you know, him fighting crime or whatever. This is about a young boy learning how to deal with powers, how to deal with these crazy things that he's being told by his parents, and how his parents are reacting to that. And Peter Tomasi, Patrick Gleason as storytellers continue to take advantage of that and to tell this story beautifully.
Those guys just know the father-son dynamic, even if it's not between fathers and sons, because they knocked it out of the park on Batman and Robin in the New 52 and are continuing to do so here. They know how to write that mentor-mentee relationship in a way that a lot of people don't.
Absolutely. And the fill-in art in this issue by Jorge Jimenez was really good. Not quite Patrick Gleason, but really good in its own right, and it didn't feel out of place at all. So big fan of this book. It was my pick of the week.
Gotcha. Do you have any books you want to do some quick hits on?
Nope, didn't read any.
Didn't read any. So I'll hit you with some quick hits of my own. Spider-Man number 6, a Civil War 2 tie-in. This, of course, being the adjectiveless Spider-Man, the Miles Morales tie-in. Absolutely love this title. But you had me – Bendis had me from word one knowing it was going to be a Jones-Miles Morales crossover issue. Batgirl and the Birds of Prey, in one sentence, the most shockingly good book of Rebirth thus far. Batgirl and the Birds of Prey Rebirth, that is, in one issue, is knocking on the door of my pull list and making it tougher for me to make this pull list, because I absolutely loved this book. Batman number 3 can best be summed up as Nick Duke marks out whenever Matches Malone appears. Star Wars 21, a good book, but I'm going to say probably the weakest issue of Jason Aaron's Star Wars thus far. Did not do much for me this week, honestly. And then finally, Hellblazer Rebirth, which kind of falls into the same trap of Green Lanterns and Justice League for me. And it's a book that I enjoyed, but without an emotional attachment to John Constantine, just being a good comic isn't enough to earn you a spot on my pull list. I don't think I'm going to be picking up any Hellblazer going forward, even though this was a decent book. I would recommend to you, however, your boy Moritant is on the art.
Ooh, from All-Star Western.
Indeed.
Fan of mine. Now.
Fan of his.
No, he's a fan of mine. He's told me many times.
At the air, I was about to say, he came up to the airport and said, you know, when are we getting the Fantasy Comics draft?
That's what he said. When are we getting the Fantasy Comics draft? He said he was a big fan of mine. And people are talking about it, you know?
Absolutely. So with all that being said, should we finally, mercifully, get into the bulk of the show?
Yes. We, folks, this is why you came here in this episode. We promised you a countdown. People love lists. People love WWE Countdown on the WWE Network for $9.99. People love the list on the WWE Network for $9.99. So we're going to give you free of charge Countdown from the Hard Traveling Fanboys. And what are we counting down this month? Well, we're counting down legacy characters. Legacy is a loaded word in comics, folks. But this, to me, is something that I'll admit defines one company over the other. It's always been associated in my eyes with DC Comics. And it's an idea of heroes age. Heroes are allowed to eventually mature and pass on their mantle and their legacy to another character. And so we're looking at some of the great figures in comics, some of the great characters who have inherited those legacies from those that came before them. And this is going to be a controversial list, I'm sure, because there are so many great picks out there, so many outstanding options to make our lists. But quite frankly, we can only go with what we've read and what we like.
Absolutely. And I believe Greg is working the Hard Traveling Fanboy gimmick, working the perception of that DC bias. Is your list, go ahead and admit it, Greg, is your list entirely DC characters?
Yes.
I came
close to including Ben Reilly as Spider-Man, but he just missed my list.
Well, with that being said, let's go ahead and hear it. Who did make your list? Who's your number five?
Starting out at number five, I have Ted Kord, the Blue Beetle.
Wow.
Yes, yes.
Wait a minute. Now, is that Ted Kord is a legacy character?
He is. And let me tell you
why.
In the words of Whispering Bill Anderson. You see, God, reference. Anyway, no one's going to get that one, Nick.
Oh, dear.
There was a character named Dan Garrett in the Golden Age.
Ah, yes, Dan Garrett. Okay, yeah, yeah.
The original Blue Beetle. And he had a student. That student's name, Ted Kord. Ted Kord, later in the Silver Age, weird enough, Charlton Comics later brought back Dan Garrett years later and made him a different character who was also the Blue Beetle in the Silver Age. It turns out that Silver Age Dan Garrett was a reincarnation of Golden Age Dan Garrett. So keep that in mind. Well, later on, DC got the rights to all these characters, and eventually we got Ted Kord, who had been invented in Charlton years later as a costumed adventurer. And what I love about Ted Kord is the fact that all you have to do is listen to Nick's reaction when I mention Blue Beetle to understand why Ted Kord is such a big deal. People don't understand that Ted Kord is the Blue Beetle is a legacy character. Or at least they don't understand that Ted Kord is a legacy character. They think Jaime Reyes
is a legacy character. Right, that's what I would have thought, yeah.
Because he inherited the mantle from Ted Kord after Infinite Crisis. However,
even though he kind of didn't. Like, the origins are so completely different.
Yeah, the origins are completely different, yeah. But, in fact, Jaime's origin is more similar to Dan Garrett's origin, finding the Scarab and all that stuff. But Ted is Blue Beetle in the minds of most people. Either he or Jaime, but people think that the legacy began with him. And that shows the work that guys like, primarily, let's be honest, Keith Giffen and J.M. DeMatteis did
and
with Ted Kord.
While we're being honest, Greg, let's go ahead and own up to it. Why do guys like me and you have an affinity for Ted Kord?
Because he's a bit of a loser.
And he struggled with, you know,
carried a little bit of excess weight.
I mean, Scott Steiner might have certain thoughts about Mr. Kord, and I wonder what those would sound like.
He's fat!
Fat son of a bitch.
Go make me an egg! Fat asses!
In any event,
he carried a bit of a paunch, and he was a loser. He struck out with the ladies almost constantly, despite his best attempts. He basically is best known for his get-rich-quick schemes with Booster Gold while they were in the Justice League together. And Nick, I know you also have a special affinity for that era of the Justice League.
Oh, it's among my favorite Justice Leagues ever, honestly. Love that era of the Justice League.
The blah-ha-ha era
for,
of Justice
four
League.
Reasons we get into in just a little bit.
Ooh, the plot thickens. So with that being said,
or as you should have said, curiouser
and
curiouser.
First down 10.
No flash.
Ted Kord is my pick for number 5. He defined the character. Nobody remembers Dan Garrett. So that's my pick for number 5.
Awesome. For my number 5, I'm going to jump over to the DC animated universe. And yes, I'm going to say the animated universe. I know this character we're about to talk about has appeared in comics, but I know him from the animated universe. This character is a concept that on paper sounds stupid, that on paper should not have worked, that I should have hated, that I should have just never wanted to exist. And yet, it winds up being really damn good in execution. I'm talking, of course, about Terry McGinnis, Batman Beyond. This is a version of the Batman mythos set in Neo-Gotham, which is, of course, the most 1999/2000s name you could ever come up with for a futuristic city. And the conceit of it is that the Bruce Wayne of Batman the Animated Series has become far too old to carry on the mantle of Batman. And
He's old. He's just so old.
Look at him. He's just so damn old. Funnily enough, Bruce was able to trouble Terry McGinnis for a warm glass of shut the hell up. In any event, this is a guy who was able to – who basically found his way into the Batcave after stumbling onto Wayne Manor – Wayne Manor grounds when he was chased by the Joker gang in the future. And he winds up taking on the mantle of Batman at Bruce's behest, essentially. Bruce endorses him. And we get this really cool dynamic where Bruce essentially becomes the Alfred. Well, not really the Alfred. That isn't a fair term. Kind of like a hybrid between Alfred and Stick from Daredevil, where it's he is the voice inside Terry's head at all times, but he is a sarcastic asshole version of that. It is every bit what you would imagine old man Bruce Wayne to be. In a dream world, there is a world where we have a Clint Eastwood Dark Knight Returns movie. But there's also an accompaniment movie where it's basically Clint Eastwood screaming at Terry McGinnis through a headset for 2 hours.
You're doing it wrong, kid.
Exactly. This is, McGinnis is a character I didn't think I was going to warm up to, but I wound up loving this character as the show went on. Batman Beyond Return of the Joker stands as not just one of my favorite Batman Beyond things, but one of my favorite Batman media adaptations in general. Just a fantastic character that broke out of Bruce's shadow, honestly, in a way that no other character was allowed to in the DCAU. Not even Dick Grayson, not even Tim Drake were afforded as high a profile as Terry McGinnis eventually reached. So much so that the show is so beloved now that, as I mentioned earlier, he has made his way into DC Comics. One of the notable examples of that show, impacting the comics and not vice versa. So I'm going with Terry McGinnis as my number 5.
Yep, I have to be honest, Nick. As you know, I was adamantly opposed to the concept of Batman Beyond for many, many years. Do you know what turned me around on it?
Return of the Joker?
Nope. The episode of Justice League Unlimited called Epilogue.
Yeah, Epilogue. Yep, where they tie everything back together.
Yep. And after that, I don't think I'll ever be a fan per se, but after that, I was like, you know what? I'm cool with that.
Have you seen
so
a lot of
badass.
The show?
I've watched a little bit of it. I've watched probably about 12 or 13 episodes combined of Beyond, and it's okay. It did its job. It did what I got what it was going for, but I think it'll always be near the bottom of my favorites in the DCU.
Fair enough. But now that you have that appreciation for it, I think it would be good. For
I think
you
to
revisit
good
it with
like
fresh
to go
eyes.
Back. Because I died with Superman the Animated Series after finishing Justice League Unlimited, the most recent time I rewatched it. I went back and watched all the episodes of Superman the Animated Series, and it's so amazing, and it ties into Justice League so greatly. So
right, and there are some episodes of Batman Beyond that are heavily Bruce-focused, even though he's not the center of the action. And those episodes in particular are outstanding.
And like I said, Terry's usage in Epilogue was phenomenal, so no complaints there.
Plus, let's admit it, the suit is just freaking cool.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Definitely. So yeah, no problem with that pick, Nick. That brings me to my number four, and this won't come as any surprise to you. My number four pick is actually the ultra-rare double legacy character. And by that I mean a character that has filled two legacy roles. And that would be Courtney Whitmore.
Ah, yes.
She has been she started out as the second Star-Spangled Kid, and then she later became Stargirl and inherited the throne of the Starman legacy from Jack Knight.
Right.
Which is really cool.
Yep.
Courtney is a character of which there are a few that Geoff Johns has created that are based on actual people from his life. And in this case, Courtney was actually a character he wrote to help him get over the death of his sister in a tragic the TWA flight that went down in the mid-90s. His sister was on that flight. His sister's name was Courtney. And so this character of Courtney Whitmore has always been very important to him. He created her and actually wrote the series Stars and Stripes, which was his first series at DC Comics. And Courtney is the all-American girl. She's she's in high school. She hates her stepdad and does anything she can to annoy him. But, of course, he's still going to try to protect her, so he builds the stripe suit and goes along with her against her wishes to protect her when she finds Sylvester Pemberton's equipment and becomes the new Star-Spangled Kid. From there, she and Stripe end up joining the JSA, written by Johns. This is very much a labor of love character for Geoff Johns. And in later years, Jack Knight, when he retired as Starman, would give her the staff, and she would become Stargirl. And one of the things that I really loved about Courtney and always have is she serves as almost a shining light in the DC universe. In a DC universe that in the 2000s got increasingly darker and darker and darker, she was still that shining light because she was still a kid. She was a teenager, yes, and a snarky teenager at that.
But endlessly optimistic.
Endlessly optimistic and somebody that brought out the best in those around her. One of the best usages of her was at the beginning of the New 52 or shortly after the New 52 started in the Justice League America title that Johns was writing. She was on that team. It was like a covert government version of the Justice League, and she was awesome. She was like the star of that book, in my opinion. And just always will have a special spot in my heart because you can tell that every time Geoff Johns writes her, he writes every bit of himself into her because she means so much to him. She means so much to me as a fan, and I'm hoping that we get to see her get a higher profile moving forward in the DC universe because she deserves it.
Absolutely. You know, my only real exposure to her is from that Justice League of America series you just referenced. So I didn't really consider her for my list. I would like to know more about her, honestly, it would be really cool if there were some kind of way, because I've read Stars and Stripe, and I would love to be able to get that book in my hands in a very convenient fashion, like, I don't know,
in a fashion that wouldn't feel limited.
Wouldn't feel limited in any way, and, maybe in some kind of, like, handheld app, for mobile devices or a tablet or even a computer,
One that you could access in the French Alps.
Yeah, in the Alps, and, which is, again, far be it from us to suggest that DC make any, industry-defining moves to get out in front of the rest of the industry and offer such a service, but, we digress once again.
Indeed. Although you did give me a good idea for potential future Longbook Hunters, so.
Do you have those traits?
I do not, but I can get my hands on them.
Awesome. So. All right, well, let's jump over to my number four, and stop me if you've heard this before, but this is once again a character, a concept that on paper I should hate, and on paper should not work. It should have been awful. And I was convinced when it happened, this is going to be terrible. There's no way I'm going to love this character. Freaking Grant Morrison created him, of all people.
Know where you're going.
But Damian Wayne as Robin is my number four selection. And I'll be honest, I think as a Robin strictly, he has become my favorite Robin of all time.
Yes, I totally agree, Nick. We are simpatico on that. And we're probably in the vast minority of people. But I agree completely. I think he is the most interesting as Robin that has ever been written. And I think that's because when Dick Grayson was Robin, it was a different era. And let's be honest, comics were not as sophisticated in those days. So most of the good Robin stories have come after he stopped being Robin.
Right. And most of the Robins, even Jason Todd, who had an attitudinal streak, as they say.
And, somewhat attitudinal.
And Tim Drake, who would challenge Bruce at times. But still, both those characters and Dick Grayson were willing to work as Bruce's subordinate, were willing to follow Bruce's lead and basically take Bruce's command without any real questioning of it, you know, in the heat of the moment. Damien, on the other hand, is a character that challenges Bruce in every way, a character that is willing to call Bruce out, to stand up to Bruce, to outright defy Bruce at times in ways that the other Robins have not been. It can certainly come off as disrespectful at times, but I would argue that level of disrespect in a way is what makes the character interesting, because
right.
You get the impression that Damien, much like Bruce, is just an emotional invalid, essentially, in that he is incapable of communicating his true feelings to his father, and that he lashes out as a result. Damien is a fantastic character. I'll give a shout out to Patrick Gleason and Pete Tomasi, especially, who have done a lot of work with the character over the years, especially Gleason in his short-lived Robin Son of Batman solo series that was actually very, very good. So Damian Wayne was a character so great that DC pretty much told Morrison to go fuck off and brought him back almost immediately after Morrison killed him off. So I love me some Damian Wayne. I hope he plays a big role going into the future. And as I said, I think he's the best Robin of all time at this point, and I can't wait to see what they have planned for him, especially his soon-to-be interactions with John Kent, who couldn't be a more different character.
Oh, totally agreed. I love that you said that about Damian, because I agree. You know, Nick, when he first came out, and you were reading Batman at that time, and you told me about it, I was adamantly opposed to it. I thought Bruce having a biological son inherently weakens his connection with his previous adopted sons. I was wrong.
Yes,
he was a great addition to the mythos, and I agree also that. Go ahead.
Especially because it's that great dichotomy, because he has a biological son, and yet he isn't – his relationship with his biological son isn't as healthy and as vibrant as his relationship with his adopted sons. And so you have that – you have that the dichotomy to play with between the various characters.
I also agree with your analysis of why he's the most interesting Robin. It's comparing the new generation to the Attitude Era. You've got the good soldier, the happy, smiling baby face in Tim Drake, and then you've got the – Attitude Era, the Rock, the Stone Cold, anti-authority, rebellious, unpredictable Damian Wayne. And to me, that's just a more interesting dynamic to introduce into Batman, because it had not been there prior to that.
Absolutely.
Even Jason had, like you said, an attitudinal streak, but it was not as explored at the time
as Damian's has been.
As it has been in hindsight.
Right.
Like looking back stories about Jason.
Right.
But at the time, Jason, you know, there was that era where he allegedly killed a guy or whatever, but it was all on the fringes. It wasn't like Damian, where it was just consistently there. So I agree with you on that.
And those aspects of Damian's personality are very out there. They're very, not only in Bruce's face, but almost in the reader's face too. Like, you have got to come to terms with who Damian is pretty quickly if you're going to read a book that has Damian in it, because I understand why a lot of people don't like him. He can be an off-putting character, but as we'll discuss in a little bit, I like me some brash, somewhat off-putting characters.
Speaking of brash and somewhat off-putting characters, and speaking of legacy, my next character, my number three character, comes from a comic book that was itself entirely about legacy. And you may know where I'm going with this, because my number three pick is Jack Knight as Starman. The James Robinson, the James Robinson, Tony Harris classic Starman series from the 90s. Jack is the third in his family to become Starman, and then
there's an alien as well.
There's several aliens actually.
Oh, I gotcha.
There's multiple other Starmen throughout the galaxy that have played the role that DC had brought in through the 60s, 70s, 80s, etc. Well. What Robinson and Harris did so cleverly is, instead of ignoring all those prior incarnations, which the prior incarnations tended to do, they embraced all of them. And they said all of them have been Starman. All of them are Starmen. And we're going to use them in this series, and we're going to play off of that. And so Jack Knight is a guy who, especially for that time, for that era, the Generation X era, he was the reader's proxy. He was a comic book fan, a nerd who liked comics and collecting things and weird, you know, antique records and stuff like that. And he just so happened to become a very reluctant superhero. And of all the reluctant superhero tropes, I'd argue he was the most successful, because that was a common thing back in the 90s, the guy that doesn't want to be a superhero but has to be. He lasted a lot longer than the Ray did. He lasted a lot longer than Damage did, in terms of the public eye anyway. So it really worked. And what makes this book work is it's a book about legacy that embraces that, but also embraces the future and toys with the idea that Jack is not going to be the last person to be Starman. There's going to be future star people. There's going to be Star Girl. There's going to be Star Woman in the distant future, who's Courtney Whitmore's sister. All of this stuff is hinted at and focused on in this series, and it really encompasses what makes DC unique, what makes DC special, what gives it its identity, which is the idea that there is this multi-generational tier of heroes. So Starman, Jack Knight in this case, is a character who is all about legacy. But James Robinson and Tony Harris did in this series that made it stand the test of time is, rather than run from all this confusing continuity from the 60s, 70s, 80s, all the way back to the 40s, of all these different people who had been called Starman, they embraced all of it, and they said it all counted. And as you can tell, Nick, that's an approach that affected Geoff Johns, our boy,
right,
years later and throughout his comic book career.
Absolutely.
That was James Robinson's approach, is all of it counts. I'm going to find a way to make it all work. And that's what he did. And he did it through creating a character that was very much a proxy for the reader. Jack Knight is a slacker. He was representative of Gen X. He loved comic books. He loved collecting things, valuables, old records, very much a part of the alternative scene. And that was pretty new. That there had not been a comic book character in a while at that point that represented the comic book fan, the contemporary comic book fan, in such a way as that. And it was also playing on what was at that time something of a trope, the reluctant superhero, the kid who doesn't want to be a superhero but becomes one, a la Spider-Man. But in this case, it worked. It worked in a way that characters like the Ray and Damage didn't work. And I think part of that is because it embraced the past, embraced the present, and embraced the future by telling us that Jack knew that he was not going to be the last person to be Starman. We were going to get Star Girl, and then we were going to get in the future Star Woman, Courtney's sister. That's all predicted and talked about in this. And I think one of the things that makes this character stand out most is that he managed to stay relevant in the DC universe over the course of one giant character arc. And when that arc was over, fittingly enough for a legacy character, Jack Knight retired. And he passed on his mantle to the next generation. And do you know what? Jack Knight has not been in DC Comics since then. And that's a pretty cool deal, in my opinion. That's the idea. When I talk about my idealization of the legacy character concept, that's the ideal. The character arc is completed, and the character is allowed to ride off in the sunset and be happy, and the next generation can take over.
Absolutely. You know, my exposure to Starman only comes from the piece of the book that you and I reviewed for a Long Book Hunters column way back when we were, you know, still operating in the dark ages of – you know, the written word and whatnot. So
actually having to put forth effort,
which is, if anybody who's listened to our podcast can tell, we're putting forth zero effort now. You know, as Enzo Amore might say, if I had a dime for every bit of effort we're putting into this, I would have zero dimes. In any event, I'm a big fan of Starman as well. Did not make my list, but you completely sold me on the concept of that being worthy of inclusion on your list. My number three entry is one that I'm not going to say a whole lot about because I don't want to steal your thunder. I don't want to take away your ability to talk about your favorite character in all of comics. So I will simply say that thanks almost exclusively to the work of Scott Snyder, in my opinion, Dick Grayson as Batman is the third greatest legacy character in the history of comics. If you have not read The Black Mirror, I highly, highly recommend it. And let me tell you how good Dick Grayson's Batman was. Even Grant Morrison's wasn't that bad.
Wow. High praise from Nick Duke.
Indeed. So I know that's coming up on your list. I don't want to take away from your thunder. And you can say much more eloquent and beautiful things about Dick Grayson than I ever could. So I will cede the floor back over to you, sir.
That's right. And at least you didn't try to steal my nitro either. So that's good.
No, I only want the sugar tamakis.
It sure is, Stevie. At number two, no shock here, I have what most people would probably put at number one, Wally West as the Flash. I mean, this is pretty open and shut here. In the majority of people our age's eyes, this isn't a case of legacy. This is a case of Wally West is the Flash. People that grew up with DC in the 80s and 90s and 2000s even, Wally West was the Flash. Most, I would argue, of what you see today in the Flash's popularity through Grant Gustin's portrayal, through the way that Barry is written now in Justice League and in his own title, we owe that to Wally West. People don't, I think, sometimes appreciate how important Wally West was to the Flash and also to DC Comics, because Wally and Dick are the only two characters who have been allowed to truly age in comics and to grow at a natural pace with the readers. There's an entire generation of people who got to read Dick Grayson as Robin, Nightwing, and Batman. And there is an entire generation of people who got to read Wally West as Barry Allen's sidekick, the Kid Flash, Kid Flash, the Teen Titan, and then The Flash, and grow into the role and mature from an immature young brat when he first became the Flash, who wasn't ready for the role, who wasn't ready for his powers, who was a playboy, who literally won the lottery and went out and bought himself a mansion and had hot chicks hanging off of him all the time, to a guy who joined the Justice League and spent the whole time hitting on Power Girl. And then from that, maturing into somebody who met the love of his life, wanted to change for her, changed, settled down, started a family, and became one of DC's greatest heroes. It's an amazing character arc. It's an example of a legacy character like Blue Beetle, like Starman, like Stargirl, who took their mantle and elevated it to a new level and redefined it for a new generation. And I love Barry Allen. I always will. But I think that the Barry Allen that we love today is not possible without the Wally West that was written by Mike Baron, by Mark Waid, by Geoff Johns. And, you know, I don't know what else to say about it, because he's one of the greatest characters in comics, not just one of the greatest legacy characters. I'm thrilled that he's back. I loved him in the DC Animated Universe as well. I got to give love to that, because, again, those were the defining characters for another generation of kids, and he was outstanding on that show, as voiced by Michael Rosenbaum. Thrilled that he's back, thrilled that a new generation of readers are going to meet him, and so Wally West is my pick for number two.
I can't disagree with that at all. If I had read more Wally West, which that's one of the black marks on my fanboy card, is I've read shockingly little. My main exposure to Wally comes from the animated universe, but you know, even as a novice to Wally, the material with him in DC Universe Rebirth was – it tugged at the heartstrings. I can only imagine what it did to see Barry and Wally, you know, together again for a lot of longtime readers. For me, my number two, I'm going to go with a character that truly embodies the idea of a hero can be anyone. For most of our existence, for most of our lives, we have known the Amazing Spider-Man as Peter Parker and only Peter Parker. And not no knock on Peter Parker, but Peter Parker is a white dude living in the slums of Queens, which is realistic to say the least. But my number two character is he represents the idea of a somewhat more realistic Spider-Man for an urban environment, a Spider-Man that speaks to demographics of comic fans that have been underrepresented for years. And I am talking, of course, about Brian Michael Bendis's creation of Miles Morales, the most recent, the final Ultimate Spider-Man, and now, as I call him, the adjectiveless Spider-Man in the main Marvel Universe. Miles is a great example of the kind of character that you and I have discussed the past couple of weeks, where he takes up a mantle, but he does it, and it is written in a way that does not make the character who came before seem obsolete or seem stupid. It makes that character seem even more essential. We've talked about ad nauseum the fact that Ultimate Peter Parker was my entry point into comics. That character will never have his place in my heart will never be topped. And so when Ultimate Peter died, at first I was completely against it. I was completely against the idea of it. I hated everything about it. I especially hated the idea of someone replacing him. But what they did was they were able to take Peter's death and make it essentially Miles' version of the Uncle Ben moment, to make it so that, you know, that death of Peter had just as big an impact on Miles as it did as Ben's death did on Peter. It was an amazing piece of writing by Brian Michael Bendis. And not only did Peter's death have an impact on Miles, but Peter's death impacted the entire Ultimate Universe in a way that I would argue no comic book death has been impacted, you know, has impacted the universe since the death of Superman in the early 90s. It was the seminal event of the Ultimate Universe. Miles, spinning out of that, has been able to grow into the role of Spider-Man on his own. He has made the character, the mantle, distinctly his own, to the point where when Ultimate Peter made a brief return in the pages of Ultimate Spider-Man, you almost kind of wish he hadn't. Or a lot of people would. You know, I can't complain about seeing Ultimate Peter back ever. But, you know, this was just a case of really showing you that Miles has taken the role and made it his own, so much so that when the Ultimate Universe folded last year, Miles was one of the few things they brought over, and for good reason. He represents something that is sorely needed in comics, and he represents, in my opinion, one of the best legacy characters in comics, which is especially cool considering Marvel doesn't have, in my opinion, an especially deep bench of legacy characters. Miles fills a role, and I can't wait to see what Marvel has in store for him, not just in the comics, but possibly some greater exposure on the film and TV side in the years to come.
That's a great point you brought up about Marvel, because we talked about this a little bit beforehand. You know, if I were keeping up with modern Marvel, I'd probably have a totally different list, because it feels like in the last 5 to 6 years, Marvel has really embraced the idea of legacy characters in a way that they never did when I was a kid. You know, when I was a kid, DC was the legacy company, and Marvel was there is one true Spider-Man, one true Wolverine, one true whoever. And now, if you look across the landscape of Marvel, you've got a new Wolverine, you've got a new Captain America, a new Thor, a new Spider-Man, a new pretty much every character. So I feel like if I had kept up more contemporaneously, I might have had Kamala Khan make my list. I might have had Carol Danvers make my list. I might have had Sam Wilson make my list. But I'm just not as up to date with those. So I mainly had to go off of characters like Danny Ketch, Ghost Rider, and things like that. Ben Reilly, of course. So
Beta Ray Bill. Point.
Beta Ray Bill.
Who of course is the second greatest Bill in all of comics, behind only Whispering Bill Anderson.
Ah, yes, the legendary Whispering Bill Anderson. And of course, who can forget Eric Thunderstrike Masterson?
Oh, God.
Don't disrespect the Thunderstrike, Nick.
Thunderstrike gargles my balls.
That's oddly specific.
Thank you.
Moving on to number one on my list. No surprise here, folks. My favorite character in all of comics, superhero or otherwise, Dick Grayson as the Caped Crusader, as Batman. This is something that has actually been visited a few times in DC lore. Most prominently for the first time in the 90s with the storyline Prodigal, which happened at the conclusion of the Nightfall saga. Bruce Wayne had his back broken and left the mantle to the newcomer, Jean-Paul Valley, which naturally ruffled the feathers of both the fandom and Dick Grayson himself.
And who naturally we hope will one day be played on the big screen by Gerard Depardieu.
And so, boy, he would be a really out of shape Ezreal, but
well, you know, it's a different take, Greg. It's a different take. You hide him in all that in all the Azbat armor, and it'll work. It can be fine.
So naturally, when Azrael, Azbats, if you will, inevitably went crazy, and Bruce had to come back and put him in his place. Bruce still wasn't ready to become Batman again, and this time he did what he should have done in the first place and called upon his prodigal son, Dick Grayson, to return home and claim the mantle. And he did, and it was a good story. And, you know, Dick fought Two-Face and dealt with some demons from his time as Robin. And it's a good story, and at the end of it, he happily relinquished the cowl back to Bruce. Flash forward through a series of unfortunate events known as the Black Glove and Batman RIP.
And Final Crisis.
And we're left with a new status quo, a battle for the cowl, if you will. And who should come out on top of that battle for the cowl? Once again, the prodigal son, Dick Grayson, who sheds his Nightwing identity because Gotham needs a Batman. And there's only one man that can fill that role in Bruce Wayne's absence, and that's Dick Grayson. And he proved that in that run, because from there we got the tremendous Grant Morrison, Frank Quitely, Batman and Robin series with Dick Grayson and Damian, quite frankly, being drawn by Frank Quitely for several issues. And you got to see the budding friendship and the relationship between Dick and Damian. And then especially the Black Mirror by Scott Snyder that Nick has already referenced. But what makes Dick Grayson the natural one to inherit the throne? First of all, yes, he was the first. He was the first Robin, the first in line of succession, so that makes sense. Second of all, he's already done many of the things that Batman has done, and some might argue, done them better. He led the Teen Titans. He went out and did that on his own, and they had their own adventures and stayed together and stayed cohesive in a way that Justice League couldn't. And Batman himself has said that Dick Grayson is the great uniter in the DC universe. People will follow him. They'll follow him to the ends of the earth because he has the confidence, the swagger, the respect level that Batman has, the fear level even that Batman has, but he combines it with the hope, the optimism, the overwhelming love that Superman has. And so you get this great balance of dark and light with his character that I don't think is equal, certainly in the DC pantheon. It's like I always looked at him as DC's closest true equivalent to Spider-Man in that he balances pathos with humor. And he is the quippiest of all the DC superheroes, short of Plastic Man. But he's also grounded in reality, and he's grounded in street-level justice. And he's got that impending sense of tragedy that's always going to loom over him because he lost his parents at an early age to murder, which is a pretty big deal. So I could talk about Dick Grayson for 3 hours, and I get sick of it. But I'll cut it short here and just say – He is the best legacy character in comics. He's my favorite legacy character in comics. He's my favorite character in comics because he encompasses everything that I want superhero comics to be. He's not one extreme or the other. He's a balance. He's a mix. And isn't that what comics are supposed to be?
Greg, that was an impassioned, well-reasoned argument for Dick Grayson as the number one legacy character in comics that really highlights, you know, the emotional impact he's had on you and your attachment to him. That was well said and perfectly stated, sir.
Thank you.
I will be doing none of that because my number one legacy character in all of comics, and some people are already going to say, "Oh, that's not a legacy character. He doesn't really count." Screw
yeah, you can hear Twitter talking right now, can't you? Oh, at Nick Duke 87. Oh, that ain't no legacy character. You're cheating. He's not a legacy character.
Screw you. He's whatever the hell he says he is, because he is the greatest of all the Green Lanterns. Baby, Guy freaking Gardner is my top legacy character in all of comics. And I say he counts because at one point he did take up the role of the main Green Lantern of Earth in the absence of Hal Jordan and John Stewart. Why do I love Guy Gardner? What's not to love about Guy Gardner? He's freaking hilarious, for one. The man had an amnesia subplot where he forgot entire aspects of his personality because he got smacked in the freaking head. That happened. That's a real thing. And it gave us the Guy Gardner that we know and love today. The asshole. The lovable, lovable asshole. The guy who uses his Green Lantern ring not to make beautiful constructs or to enhance the architecture of something the way John Stewart would, but instead to write bye-bye bats across his bare ass cheeks and stick them to the window of the watchtower. Guy Gardner, my friends, is the greatest legacy character of all of comics. It's not close. Hell, he might be the greatest character, period, in all of comics. And my only regret about Guy Gardner is that we will not get to see The Rock play him, as should have happened one day.
Guy Gardner might be the greatest character in comics. Just ask him.
Just ask him, he'll tell you. And yeah, sure, there was that whole one punch incident. Yeah, sure, whatever. But that doesn't take away from the fact that you know it deep down in your hearts every time you've picked up a Guy Gardner comic, every damn time you've been entertained. And isn't that what comics are supposed to do? Entertain? Guy Gardner, my friends. Guy freaking Gardner.
Let me pose a challenge to all of our listeners out there. If you have your graphic novel copy of The Death of Superman, I want you to go through and I want you to read it, and I want you to find a character named Mitch. And I want you to compare Mitch's Guy Gardner super fandom to Nick's Guy Gardner super fandom. And maybe we can make something happen here where one day we can submit this to Jeff Johns and Zack Snyder and those in charge of the DC Extended Universe, and we might be able to get Nick Duke cast as Mitch on the big screen.
I think I would be the perfect role of young preteen Mitch. I think I could play him.
I think, yeah, exactly. Just shave, you know, wear a wig. You could pull it off. Absolutely. No, I mean, hey, all of that being said, I got nothing against that pick. I love me some Guy Gardner. I mean, Guy Gardner has been a favorite of mine since I was 7 years old, and I was reading Superman comics, and you know, he would go on there and talk about Superman was a spud and he was stupid and slow and, you know, he was lame and big blue Boy Scout and all that stuff. And I thought it was funny. It was humorous to me. Mitch, the super fan, you know, guy was kicked out of the Corps and had to get a yellow ring. And it was good stuff. You know, guy's a great character, and should have been played by The Rock at some point in life.
Absolutely. Did you know that Guy Gardner sired a baseball team, an orchestra, if you count the bastards?
That's right. Did you know that if you drop a phonograph needle on Gardner's nipple, it plays the Beach Boys' Pet Sounds?
Did you know that Guy Gardner's semen has the cure for leprosy? I wish I had leprosy.
I wish I had leprosy. Oh,
in all seriousness, though, Guy Gardner, in addition to the comedic aspects, which are by far the large part of the character's appeal, again, we've shouted it out before, and you can't shout it out enough. The in-depth character work that Peter Tomasi and Jeff Johns did with him during that Green Lantern Corps run was among the best character reclamation jobs in history. It actually made you care about Guy Gardner and realize there was a real human being beneath the scruffy exterior. Not that that speaks to me in any way or anything.
No, not at all. No similarities in character between any hosts of this show and Mr. Gardner in any feasible manner. With that said, that brings to an end another countdown, folks. And I think what we should do right now is give people a rundown of our picks, of who our five through ones were. I'll start us off. At number five, I had Ted Kord, the Blue Beetle. At number four, I had Courtney Whitmore, the Star-Spangled Kid, a.k.a. Stargirl. At number three, I had Jack Knight as Starman. At number two, Wally West as the Flash. And at number one, Dick Grayson as Batman. Nick?
At number five, I had Terry McGinnis as Batman Beyond, if you will. At number four, I had Damian Wayne as Robin. At three, Dick Grayson as Batman. At two, Miles Morales as the Ultimate Spider-Man. And at number one, the greatest Green Lantern of them all, Guy Gardner, baby.
With that said, folks, this is always the most controversial of our shows. So please let us hear your lists. Go to the Facebook page, Place to Be Nation Comics on Facebook. Join us. Give us your lists. Tell us who you think we left out. Tell us who didn't belong on. And let's engage in this debate, because I know we left out a lot of great legacy characters here. Tons of great legacy characters. Tell us your favorites. And you can hit us up on Twitter, at gphillips8652, at nickduke87. Drop us an email, gregp@placetobenation.com, nickd@placetobenation.com. Let us know. We're always open to suggestions. We're starting a whole new episode in a few months based on...
Next month, actually.
Next month, based on listener suggestion.
September, excuse me. So about 6 weeks.
Right. So, we will listen to suggestions, folks. And just like good old JR, you know, you have a right to your opinion, even if it's wrong.
Even if it's wrong. Just like you people who inevitably say, oh, Guy Gardner's not a legacy character. Not a legacy character. Well, that's your opinion.
You know who else wasn't a legacy character?
Danny Hodge. That's right. That's right.
You want him to get a hold of you? I don't think so, for God's sake.
My God, he used to get a hold of men, and then they'd go to the hospital with penis crush injuries. He used to call it a Hodge job.
The Hodge job, that's right. You know what's worse than a tornado? A titty twister from Hodge. So anyway, with that being said, folks, we're going to bring it to an end. We hope you join us next week, or maybe you won't. Hell, I don't care. That's your decision to make, quite frankly.
But if you choose to join us next week, you'll be getting a very special episode of our show, as we're going to be bringing you a full-length review of – or not a full-length review, but we're going to be hitting you up with a little off-the-page. And that is, we're going to be going off-the-page to take a look at Batman v Superman, the Ultimate Cut. And we will have Russell Sellers of Sellers Points on to talk about that film, to talk about the differences between the Ultimate Cut and the theatrical cut, and to attempt to make the show 4 hours long, I'm sure.
That's right. We're going to touch the most controversial film thus far of 2016 in geek circles. So be on the lookout for that. And until next time, folks, take care of yourselves and keep watching Ho-Ho Loon do his thing.
Absolutely.
Sunshine came softly through my
All right.
window today. Could have tripped out easy, but I changed my ways. It'll take time, I know it, but in a while you're gonna be mine. I know it, you'll do it in style. 'Cause I made my mind up, you're going to be mine. I tell you right now, any trick in the book now, baby, all I can find. Everybody is hustling just to have a little scene. When I say we'll be cool, I dig that. You know what I mean. We stood on a beach at sunset. You remember when? I know a beach where, baby, it never ends. When you've made your mind up forever to
to be mine. I'll tell you right now, any trick in the book can now be me. All I can find, Superman and Green Lantern, they've got nothing on me. I can make like a turtle in a dark fog, afloat in the sea. You can just sit down thinking on your velvet throne, yeah, about a rainbow, say, you can have for your own. Cause I've made my mind up, you're going to be mine. I'll pick up your hands and slowly blow your little mind. Cause I've made my mind up, you're going to be mine. Any trick in the book, I made my mind up, you're going to be mine. I tell you right now, I made my mind up.